Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Remember, no one is going to treat you special just because you are black.
A state audit found the University of California system admitted 64 students through, quote, inappropriate channels during the previous five school years. Now, those channels include students' connections to big donors and being admitted through athletic programs despite showing little ability in those sports. Now, if this sounds like the admission scandal that rocked college campuses nationwide last year, including at USC, you are not far off. Here to talk about this is Margarita Fernandez, Chief of Public Affairs for the California State Auditor, which authored this report. Now, first off, just how much was this report motivated by that admission scandal?
It was very much so motivated by that. Assemblymember Werner Horvath is the one that requested the audit, and they were concerned about what had happened with the scandal and UC's responses to some of these allegations. So it's all related to that. They wanted to make sure that corrective action was being taken. So they requested the audit, asking us to go to three universities, UC Berkeley, UCLA, and UC San Diego. Then we added UC Santa Barbara when we were looking at, in particular, student athletes.
How did you go about auditing them?
We actually started looking at any admissions that were made, in particular with exception, and then looked at emails. We looked at information about the student athlete program, whether or not they were on rosters. So we took a deeper dive into all of the practices.
Now, your reports found 64 cases of applicants who got into one of the more competitive UC schools, even though compared against the academics, against others, they might not have made the cut. And your report calls them, quote, inappropriate factors. Now, I referenced a few earlier, but can you give us a few more details of what you count as inappropriate?
We're really talking about perhaps a student or an applicant was well-connected. Maybe the applicant's family member was the child of a high-level university staff member, or maybe they were a child of a major donor, or perhaps it was a child of a prominent alumnus. So that's what we're talking about.
Now, your report notes that most of these students were white and from families with incomes of more than $150,000 a year. Why make that specific point?
Well, that was something that the requester asked us to take a look at as well, the demographics and so forth. It was something they were concerned about, whether or not individuals who perhaps came from a background that didn't have the connections, didn't have all the contacts, or perhaps weren't related to a major donor.
We're talking to Margarita Fernandez, Chief of Public Affairs for the California State Auditor. Now, for perspective, UC schools admitted nearly 150,000 students for this academic year alone, finding 64 cases of possibly inappropriate admissions over the course of five previous school years. I got to be honest, does not sound like a lot.
Yeah, we only looked at four campuses, but there were 400 others that were questionable that we found. And we also, on top of that, looked at the entire admission practices. Some of these reviewers, that they have two reviewers per application, and they're not trained, not monitored. So I might be someone who's applying and might get lucky, and I have someone who is lenient.
But isn't that just the luck of the draw, though, Margarita? I mean, it's just, you know, sometimes we're all human beings, and sometimes people are more strict, and sometimes people are more lenient.
You're right. It's a luck of a draw. There's always going to be some subjective nature in this because we're all human. But training them, monitoring their work, trying to make sure that they have the equipment or the tools that they need to try to make it as consistent as possible is something that that the university should want to do to make sure that people trust the system.
On the point, though, of training people doing the reviewing, something stood out to me in the summary of recommendations, and I'll just read it verbatim here. Before admitting prospective student athletes, verify their athletic talents. I don't know if I could recognize someone who is an expert rower or diver. How is that going to be done to make sure that the people doing the reviewing of, say, someone that's trying to become a student at a UC campus that is an athlete is legitimately an athlete?
What we saw a lot of is email correspondence between, like, the development department, which is the fundraising arm for the university, and perhaps coach. When you're looking at the students, not necessarily the reviewer, but it could be someone else who is taking a look at that. Someone external, perhaps, from the coach that even just investigates a little bit to determine if that person plays in high school and how well they've done in high school. You can Google and get some information fairly easily. So even just doing a review or trying to validate that that person, in fact, is a top rated in that particular sport would give some comfort as far as knowing whether or not these individuals who are called a student athlete are in fact a student athlete.
Okay. Now, I understand overseeing and reviewing the admissions process is important, and you made those recommendations to shore up that process. But what's on the line when the state almost micromanages each UC school's methods for who gets admitted?
So, you know, we recognize that, too, that the campuses need to have some autonomy as well. But the Office of the President could take a little bit stronger role. They have a system-wide auditor. So they do have the ability to try to ensure that they can build a public trust in this admissions process, that it's not going to be unfair depending on what your connections are with the university. So just even ensuring that they do a review every 3 years or so still gives campuses the autonomy of ensuring that they're implementing certain admission practices.
Ultimately, though, it does depend on state lawmakers and the schools themselves. So I'm wondering, who should the public look to for making changes with our public universities going forward?
We can't enforce the corrective action, but, you know, the public can. Also to the legislature. Legislature provide funding to the university every year. They will often have hearings on any of the audits that we conduct, and the legislature can enforce some action on this.
That's Margarita Fernandez, Chief of Public Affairs for the California State Auditor. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Medical apartheid, the dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans, from colonial times to the present.
Black Americans are more likely than white Americans to have a serious mental illness or Alzheimer's disease. Despite that fact, studies of these disorders often exclude people with African ancestry. Now, a group of scientists and community leaders is working to change that. Here's NPR's John Hamilton.
Mental illness can run in families. Dr. Kafweed Zarasa knows all about that.
My family members suffer from a broad range of illnesses that we would diagnose as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and depression.
In medical school, Zarasa learned how profoundly those disorders had affected his relatives.
So learning about family members that were committed in different hospitals, a family member that went missing, and we discovered them in an alleyway. And I wanted to dedicate my career to figuring out how to make science relevant to ultimately help my own family.
Zarasa became a psychiatrist and scientist at Duke University and began exploring the links between genes and mental illness. Then he realized something.
I was studying genes that were specifically related to illness in folks of European ancestry.
Zarasa's family came from West Africa, and people with his genetic background were largely missing, both from research studies and from the entire field of neuroscience.
I suddenly found myself in this enterprise where it was like, we don't have folks studying the illness. We're not represented in the genes. The medications don't work as well. And it was a really crushing moment for me.
So when a group in Baltimore asked Zarasa to help do something about the problem, he said yes. The group is the African Ancestry Neuroscience Research Initiative. It was created in 2019 by community leaders and the Lieber Institute for Brain Development. Dr. Daniel Weinberger, Lieber's CEO, says including more Black people in genetic studies is the first step.
When it comes to studies of the brain, which are critical for translating these big population genetic studies into understanding mechanisms of disease, you have to study brains. You have to have brains.
And in the past decade, the Lieber Institute has received more than 700 of them from African-American families who donated the brain of a relative who died. Weinberger says the African Ancestry Initiative is making the most of that resource.
We have produced molecular data, detailed molecular data, on about 300 brains of African Americans, plus about 1,000 brains of European ancestry.
One question the initiative hopes to answer is why African Americans appear twice as likely to develop Alzheimer's. And it's also looking at ways African ancestry seems to protect people from the disease. For example, Weinberger says, studies show that inheriting two copies of a gene variant called APOE4 increases the risk of Alzheimer's at least tenfold in white people.
If you're of African ancestry, the risk from inheriting that gene from both your parents is about a fourth of what it is if you're of European ancestry.
Understanding why might lead to a drug that helps everyone. This sort of research is tricky in a nation that has mixed science and racism. Reverend Alvin Hathaway is the pastor of Union Baptist Church in Baltimore and a leader of the Neuroscience Initiative.
When you begin to talk about the brain, you begin to talk about genomic data set, immediately within the community, that triggers all kinds of suspicions.
So Hathaway is making sure this effort is transparent and inclusive. He decided to involve Morgan State University, a historically black school in Baltimore, and he went to the Lieber Institute with a big request.
That I should have persons from Morgan at every step of this process, from technicians to principal investigators to researchers, and there was overwhelming acceptance of that.
Hathaway says efforts to increase diversity often leave fundraising to white people.
But in this process, every step of the way, even in terms of capital formation, we've been actively, acutely involved in that. So much so, one of the early principal investors was a African-American investor.
In July, the initiative got a $1 million commitment from Brown Capital Management, a black-owned business in Baltimore. The state of Maryland has promised another $1.25 million. And all of that is gratifying to brain researcher Kafweed Zarasa.
I go in every day believing that that is the day that I will make the discovery that is going to totally transform my family's life.
If he does, it will transform the lives of many other families as well. John Hamilton, NPR News.
As soon as he was sworn in as chancellor, the Nazis unfurled their swastikas, a Sanskrit symbol linking them to their Aryan roots.
There's a debate in this country over symbols and statues and place names that are tied to white supremacy. So what to do about a small community in rural northern New York called Swastika? This summer, a visitor proposed just changing the name, but local officials opposed the idea. Julia Ritchie from North Country Public Radio explains why.
Michael Alcamo lives in New York City, but loves visiting the Adirondack Mountains in upstate New York to cycle through its tiny towns and hamlets and past historical cemeteries. He was on a trip like this, winding through a remote stretch this summer, when he noticed something else.
Suddenly I came to a town called Swastika.
The hamlet's name was printed on a small brown street sign. He says he found the name jarring and disrespectful to veterans of World War II, some of whom are buried in graves nearby.
So I think it should be obvious that the town should update its name and should pick a name that is not so offensive to so many Americans and so emblematic of intolerance, hate, and tyranny.
So Alcamo reached out to county officials in August to see if they would consider it. He was soon directed to email the town of Blackbrook, which has jurisdiction over Swastika. The town agreed to add it to the agenda for their September meeting, and after about 5 minutes of discussion, the town's four councilors unanimously voted against it.
So basically, Swastika was named by the founders of the area that settled there.
That's Blackbrook Supervisor John Douglas, who was at the meeting but didn't have a vote. None of the councilors returned a request for comment. Douglas says the hamlet's name far predates World War II and came from the Sanskrit word meaning well-being. The four-sided geometric character that represents the swastika has been used for thousands of years in Indian religions and seen as a symbol of good luck. Of course, that meaning was overshadowed beginning in the 1930s with the rise of Adolf Hitler, who co-opted the swastika as a symbol for Nazism and anti-Semitism. Douglas says this is not the first time the hamlet's name has been scrutinized.
There was concern that due to the Germans and everything, that people may have a different outlook on the name. And some of the residents that were from that area actually fought in World War II and refused to change the name just because Hitler tried to tarnish the meaning of swastika.
Douglas says the council didn't see a reason to change the name, despite its widespread use as a symbol of hate and white supremacy today.
I think that's probably maybe some viewpoint that it's associated with hate, but then I believe there's others that do not associate it with hate. Did the Hindus and the Buddhas and all them, did they erase it from their religious history because of the Germans?
Alchemo, the cyclist who submitted the request, was disappointed by the town's reaction.
I didn't expect a apparently quick unanimous vote to reject the proposal.
Social media response to the decision has been murkier, with some locals of the region bristling on Facebook at an outsider from New York City trying to meddle in rural affairs. But Alchemo says he simply wants more people to see the Adirondacks for its natural beauty and deep history. A history, he says, at odds with the meaning of swastika today. For NPR News, I'm Julia Ritchie in Potsdam, New York.
In Florida, the storied Miami Herald newspaper is known for its investigative reporting. And now the newspaper is turning its attention onto itself, as the newsroom is in crisis. It's dealing with the fallout of the revelation that it had distributed a Spanish-language periodical with anti-Semitic and other offensive material to subscribers of its Spanish-language sister paper, El Nuevo Herald. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik has been reporting on this and joins us now. Hi.
Good morning, Lulu.
David, what happened here?
So let's set it out. El Nuevo Herald, as you said, is the Spanish-language sister paper, the Miami Herald. It's distributed. Inside it was tucked in a paid relationship a very strong anti-Castro publication called Libre. It's put out by a Cuban-American who was an active politician for years, also a felon who was investigated by the Miami Herald. They paid since January to have this put in there. That publication had within it a number of columns that were racist, that were anti-Semitic, and one or two examples, and I apologize, they're offensive, but you know, at one point a columnist described Michelle Obama as reminding him of a black monster from Dante's Inferno. He described Islam as filth and Native Americans as primitive, and really was angry about Black Lives Matter, essentially at one point calling the protesters, saying that they should be summarily put to death. The most amazing thing about this was it turned out that this kind of material was appearing in this publication tucked inside El Nuevo Herald in this paid relationship ever since January. It had been going on for 8 months.
8 months? I mean, that seems like an extraordinary length of time for a newspaper of such sophistication and renown. How is that allowed to happen?
Well, this was called out on Twitter by Billy Corbin. He's a documentary maker and a founder of a brand new news aggregation site called Because Miami. And it appears to have been allowed to happen by the Herald's own account by virtue of the fact that nobody in editorial or management position was reading any of this material before it went to print and was tucked in. And as it turns out, after as well. So that you were really having a scenario in which there was no responsibility taken for what they were incorporating. And this was not labeled as an advertisement. This was essentially tucked in. Readers would not have – it was slickly produced. One of the key columnists saying some of the most racist and anti-Semitic material was himself a former El Nuevo Herald columnist for 9 years, really very little ability for readers to discern that this wasn't editorial content. And two complaints – I will say the review by the paper found two complaints were registered and not passed along to leaders of the paper.
Does this say something about the Spanish language press in Florida or just this particular publication?
I think it is more telling about Spanish language press in that state. You know, if you think about particularly in Miami and Latino culture is so dominated by Cuban Americans down there, the latitude in the Latin American press and in Spanish language press there is much broader for sort of what we would think of as fairly incendiary statements, particularly when it carries conservative or anti-communist rhetoric along with it against the Cuban regime.
And what does it tell us about the Herald and its place now in the community?
Well, Herald leaders say they're going to do outreach and talk to Black and Jewish leaders in particular about what has happened, make restitution. They've apologized lavishly. But right now, there are two things to take away. First, the Herald's been cut to the bone. It was just bought out of bankruptcy by an investment firm, and maybe they didn't have enough bodies to review. And secondly, the Herald itself didn't allow its own executives to be interviewed by its reporters, who did, I thought, a very intelligent job trying to explain to the public what occurred. And I think there's been a lack of transparency in that regard that the community may feel, and that certainly the journalists I've talked to within the Herald say they note very strongly.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Thanks so much.
You bet.
Lawmakers, the politicians, the Colombian drug lords, all you who lobby against making drugs legal, just like you did with alcohol during the Prohibition. You're the one who's guilty. I mean, come on, let's kick the ballistics here. Ain't no Uzis made in Harlem. I mean, not one of us in here owns a poppy field. This thing is bigger than Nino Brown. This is big business. This is the American way.
Some of the world's biggest banks have allowed criminals to move dirty money around the world, according to leaked documents covering about $2 trillion worth of transactions. The 2,500 documents, mostly files that banks sent to the US authorities between 2000 and 2017, were leaked to BuzzFeed News and shared with investigative journalists around the world. They show how Russian oligarchs used banks to avoid sanctions that were supposed to stop them getting their money into the West, as well as money laundering and financial crime. In one case, HSBC allowed a gang of fraudsters to move millions of dollars despite being warned by US investigators it was a scam. Andy Verity is the BBC's economic correspondent. He's been talking to my colleague James Menendez.
HSBC was mixed up in a scam a number of years ago called World Capital Markets, where American investors lost tens of millions of pounds and HSBC was handling the money for the people who later turned out to be fraudsters. And when the American authorities notified HSBC and asked them about the accounts linked to the fraudsters, they didn't tell them that actually some of those fraudsters had accounts with the bank in Hong Kong, and they even continued to move money after the US authorities had been in touch about the scam. Now, they stole $80 million, and HSBC let the fraudsters move the stolen cash around the world even when it was notified, and didn't tell the US authorities. And we asked HSBC about this. They wouldn't comment on the fraud, but they said it had been a multi-year journey to overhaul their ability to combat financial crime. And they said that the regulator had concluded that HSBC had become a safer bank each year as a result of the bank's efforts.
And yet, some of our listeners may remember that HSBC got into a bit of trouble in Mexico. And this was what, about the same time?
In fact, that happened just before. So the context is really interesting here at the time. HSBC was more or less on probation with the US authorities because in 2012, the US Senate committee did a report about HSBC saying that it had become a conduit for drug kingpins and also sanctioned countries. In particular, it was found to have such lax controls, a spectacular failure of oversight, as the US authorities described it, that it permitted the Sinaloan drug cartel, which listeners may know from the Netflix series El Chapo, to launder $881 million through its Mexico branch. Now, it just escaped prosecution for this, and we found out 4 years later that the British finance minister, our Chancellor George Osborne at the time, had intervened and written to the top US legal official, Eric Holder, saying that he was anxious to avoid a prosecution. And that actually happened. There hadn't been a prosecution. There was instead a deferred prosecution agreement whereby HSBC had to keep its nose dead clean for 5 years in order to avoid a criminal prosecution. Yet we only know from this leak, not from anything the authorities have told us, that this was going on a year later.
What is the big picture in terms of the way the global banking system works and how easy it is for criminals and other unsavory characters to move their money around? I mean, there are meant to be checks and balances about this, aren't there?
Well, yes, and this leak is actually showing us part of what are supposed to be those checks and balances. Banks, when they see something dodgy happening, like round figure sums going to entities they don't know, they're supposed to file suspicious activity reports, which highlight what they're concerned about. Now, those suspicious activity reports aren't proof of crime. They're just concerns being raised. But what's supposed to happen is that the authorities then act. If there are too many red flags, as they call them, too many warning signs, they're supposed to act. And all you have to do is compare the relatively sparse number of prosecutions there have been for money laundering, for example, in this country, with the volume of suspicious activity reports filed and the gravity of the assertions made in them. Just looking at the UK's role, for example, the UK, we found out from one of the leaked documents, is regarded by US Treasury, an intelligence document that's in the leak, as a higher risk jurisdiction on a par with Cyprus. And that's partly because it's been shown that you can have companies in the UK which are filing accounts saying they've got turnovers of £23,000, which turn out to have hundreds of millions of dollars of Russian cash moving through them. Now, if the system's that wide open, it's not a system that's effectively working to prevent money laundering.
Our economics correspondent, Andy Verity.
There are rumors that have gone viral on Twitter and Facebook that left-wing activists started the fires, the wildfires in Oregon. Those rumors are false, but so far these companies have failed to stop misinformation, some of it dangerous, from spreading. Facebook, I should note, is a financial supporter of NPR, and here's our Shannon Bond.
Cameron Hill and his family were fleeing fires in Clackamas County, south of Portland, and they'd heard some disturbing rumors.
I heard that police had several activists in custody down in Eugene, starting fires.
That's Hill talking with Oregon Public Broadcasting's Monica Samayoa. These arson claims were not true, but they were lighting up social media. The rumor was the fires had been set by anti-fascist activists, known as Antifa, or Black Lives Matter protesters. The rumors caused so much disruption, local police departments took to Facebook and Twitter to beg people to stop spreading them. They said there was no evidence that any political or activist groups were behind the fires. Tim Fox is a captain with the Oregon State Police.
You know, all these rumors and things that are going around are tough because we have to find people to respond to them, to investigate them, to check them out.
Part of the reason these claims spread so widely on Facebook is that the world's biggest social network rewards engagement. Posts that get lots of shares, comments, and likes get shown to more people, quickly amplifying their reach. As the fire rumors proliferated, Facebook did put warnings on some posts its fact-checkers found false. And after the FBI put out a statement debunking the rumors, Facebook began removing posts entirely. But by then, the rumors had been circulating for several days.
And what that said to us is that they're waiting too long.
Karen Kornbluh and her research team at the German Marshall Fund found these rumors spreading in private Facebook groups, some with hundreds of thousands of members. And the claims were being amplified by social media accounts known to spread false information, like followers of QAnon, a baseless conspiracy theory. A Facebook spokesman says the company acts aggressively to stop misinformation. But what happened in Oregon shows that once this kind of hoax starts spreading, it's really hard to stamp out.
When you think of the psychology of misinformation, you know, you can think of something like molding clay.
Dolores Albarracin is a psychology professor at the University of Illinois.
And when you have soft clay, you can print anything you want onto it. Once it dries out, though, that's it. Your print or shape is set.
So while fact checks and removing posts can help, the real challenge is stopping harmful hoaxes from going viral in the first place. And some experts have a new idea about how to hit pause on social media's powerful amplification engine. Aaron Simpson at the left-leaning Center for American Progress says the inspiration is the stock market.
So if the S&P drops really suddenly, we've had these thresholds in place for, you know, a lot of years now that the market will stop and that will automatically trigger like review.
Those automatic triggers are called circuit breakers. Simpson says that's what social media needs, a circuit breaker to stop the viral spread that platforms are designed to encourage. So when a controversial topic is gaining steam, Facebook or Twitter could limit its reach while reviewing disputed information.
A system like this could maybe make it harder for stuff to go viral, instead of the status quo, which is a set of Facebook business products make it easier to go viral.
The idea is even gaining traction inside Facebook. It says it's testing this kind of speed bump for viral posts. Shannon Bond, NPR News.
White supremacy is the sickness.
200,000. The U.S. will reach that number of coronavirus deaths this week. That is a fifth of all COVID-related deaths in the world. And it is Black and brown communities that have suffered the most. We wanted to take this moment to remember some of those lives and to go back to the beginning, to New York City, one of the earliest and deadliest coronavirus hotspots.
She taught us how to become men and women.
Desanne Romaine was the first known educator from the New York City public school system to die from the coronavirus back in March. And that was one of her students, Curtis Turney. Romaine was the beloved principal of Brooklyn Democracy Academy, a transfer high school for students who struggled in the traditional school system. Romaine had moved from Trinidad to New York as a teenager, and she often shared her own struggles in school with her students.
She was understanding and tough at the same time, which made us so relatable. Ms. Romaine, after graduating from high school, became more than just a former teacher to most of us, but a great friend, and most of all, a hero to so many of us.
She was just 36 when she died, and Romaine left behind words of wisdom when she spoke at last year's graduation ceremony.
Understand that you are great in your own right, and don't let anybody ever make you feel less than.
1 month on from Romaine's death, the pandemic had grown and spread, and another community leader lost his battle with COVID-19. Akbar Nurdin Shabazz was the first Muslim chaplain in the Texas prison system. He died April 23rd, just outside Houston. He was 70 years old. His friends and colleagues described a man who gave up a lot to put inmates on the path to a better life. Basil Abdullah, whose life sentence was reversed, says coming into contact with Shabazz
put me into a life I could not have lived. The things that I have done could not have happened.
Akbar Nurdin Shabazz Jr. looks back and wishes he could tell his father how proud of him he was.
Of course, I told him, you know, that I love him and that kind of thing. But after he passed, I really started to hear the impact he had on others.
Since Texas prisons started mass testing in April, the state has consistently ranked highest in the country for both number of cases and deaths in prison populations.
The coronavirus swept into many Native American communities early and into the summer. Native Americans have seen 3.5 times as many cases as white Americans. Among them was Edna Raper of the Cherokee Nation, who died of COVID-19 on July 4th. Raper was one of 2,000 remaining speakers of the Cherokee language, and she cared deeply about passing it on to her children and her grandchildren. Here's Raper's daughter, Sarah Pickup. Whenever her mother would babysit Pickup's daughters,
she'd start singing in Cherokee, and that's how she'd put them to sleep.
Pickup says Raper was committed to her community around Tulsa, Oklahoma. On many days, she got in her silver Chevy Malibu and helped people without transportation.
She would, like, take them to doctor's appointments or go get their groceries, just anybody in the community that needed help.
Raper's granddaughter, Madison Gardner, says she wants to honor her grandmother's legacy by teaching Cherokee to the next generation.
She's a really honest and wise woman, so she taught me a lot, and hopefully I get to teach my kids and my nieces and nephews as much as she has taught me.
Edna Raper was 67 years old.
Actually, in this country, we get very little reporting really about how corona is affecting the African continent. What is it, how is corona actually reported on the African continent in America? You know, what is there anything reported about corona on that continent, or is it zero?
Well, much of the world is still struggling to get the coronavirus under control. Africa seems to have turned the tide. It has far fewer cases and deaths than Europe, Asia, or the Americas. And the number of reported new infections has been going down by about 10% a week. John Nkengasong is the director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
We are not seeing people around the continent falling dead around the streets or mass barriers going on the continent. And we are actively looking for those scenarios, and it's not. So I think our scenario reflects actually the early interventions that countries took, the recognition that we have to apply these public health measures massively and consistently, and I think that is working.
Our reporter Richard Hamilton told us more about the interventions and other factors that John Nkengasong said had helped Africa.
He said that they scaled up testing, they had lockdowns, they had contact tracing, that people have worn masks. This is all the Center for Disease Control talking up how good they've responded. But in reality, one of the main factors here is that Africa has an extremely young population. The average age is 18, as opposed to Europe, where the average age is 42. And also in Africa, you don't tend to have existing health problems like diabetes or obesity that you get in Europe. So that may be a large factor. He also said that because Africa, and particularly West Africa, had dealt with epidemics like Ebola, a lot of the countries were geared up for these sort of health crises already. And the early predictions have been confounded because the early forecasts were quite apocalyptic, suggesting that African health services would be overwhelmed. And the fact that they're not has sort of puzzled experts. And last week, Professor Francesco Cecchi, who's a specialist in epidemiology at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, said we're observing a pattern that confounds us a little. And they suggest that one possibility is that many people in Africa have pre-existing immunity to COVID-19 caused by exposure to other infections.
And how robust are the figures that show Africa's got the epidemic under control? Because there was some suggestion that infections and indeed deaths were being missed.
Yes, so the International Rescue Committee said recently that the true scale of the pandemic may have been hidden because of a lack of testing and issues with data. So, for example, Kenya recently changed its testing to focus just on high-risk groups, and that resulted in the case numbers dropping. Similarly, South Africa has changed its testing just to more vulnerable groups. But Dr. Nkenga Song says that this is a false narrative and that they are doing things correctly.
And what about those herbal remedies that we saw early on?
So the World Health Organization has now agreed rules for testing herbal remedies. And they're saying that as long as they're proved to be efficacious, that they should go ahead. And this is a bit of a change of tack because previously they'd poured scorn on these traditional remedies. They still want to emphasize that they shouldn't be taken unless they're effective. But they're saying that there should be some sort of process and broader testing before they go to manufacture.
Richard Hamilton.
When you don't vote, you can't sit on a jury. You have no right to complain about the police because you won't even go and vote so you can even sit on a jury. As I've told, said to the cows when I first started to call in, I spent 11 years on a job where I worked for a bank and had to sit in court day after day, after day, after day. And I watched them select juries. I watched Black people going to jail, Black people having white probation officers, and the whole judicial system just truncated with white supremacy. And a great deal of it could be lessened if Black people simply voted.
Some Black St. Louis senior citizens are worried that it will be difficult to cast their votes during the November election because of the coronavirus pandemic. Some fear their absentee or mail-in ballots will not make it to election officials on time. Others are worried that officials won't have enough voting machines or poll workers in Black neighborhoods. As St. Louis Public Radio's Andrea Henderson reports, senior citizens say they are leery of the process but hopeful that Black people will still be able to vote.
In the early 1960s, Louise Wilkerson's parents often spoke about politics and how it was important for Black people to vote. For decades, that compelled her to vote in nearly every election.
I realized when I was in high school and certainly in college that politics controls virtually everything in our lives.
The 75-year-old retired educator is determined to vote this year. But like many elderly Black North St. Louisans, she's worried that it will be hard to make sure that everyone who wants to vote can do so. Older Black voters typically like to vote at the polls. People in the high-risk category for contracting the virus, like those over 65, are encouraged to vote by mail or absentee ballot. But some worry that their ballots won't make it to the Board of Elections. Wilkerson says many voters will have to rely on the U.S. Postal Service to deliver their ballots. But when Postmaster General Louis DeJoy proposed cuts to the Postal Service, many people lost faith in the system.
We've got Postmaster General DeJoy trying to kneecap the U.S. Postal Service. We've never had an attack on the Postal Service like this. This is outrageous.
Alonza Patrick is hopeful his absentee ballot will count too, but he is largely concerned about access to the polls in North St. Louis. The 80-year-old has been driving people to and from polls for about 40 years. Patrick says he's noticed that North St. Louis polling stations tend to have more problems than stations in other areas in the city. He says in the summer elections, some voters stood in lines for hours.
Some of these polls that we visit by taking people to vote, we see long lines. So what I decided to do is go inside and find out why those lines were so long. What I found out, we didn't have enough machines, we didn't have enough tellers, and the people that was checking off the people to vote was not in a hurry to do it.
In March, the city had 105 polling stations. By the August primaries, there were 99. Gary Stoff, the St. Louis Board of Elections Republican director, says the city lost 6 polling stations because officials decided not to use senior citizens' facilities as voting locations to help limit the spread of the virus. Alderwoman Pam Boyd is a Democrat who represents the 27th Ward. She says she was furious with the conditions that elderly residents had to endure this summer when coronavirus cases were rising.
I had kept asking the Board of Elections before the election, are you going to have them where they take people's temperature? And nobody will respond. So they had nobody when they came in to have them sanitize their hands. They just had it sitting on the table. So most people going to walk past the sanitizer. Then they didn't have the social distancing in there, and then they didn't have the people wearing the masks, the workers.
Boyd and others in North St. Louis are worried that long lines at the polls is another example of how election officials in Missouri are making it hard for people to vote. Gina McClendon is director of Washington University's Voter Access and Engagement Initiative. She says some Black people don't trust the voting process.
So a lot of what people believe is historical. I'm not a value, so what difference does my vote make? But the problem is that people don't understand that that's not where we are today. Your vote does matter. And if it didn't matter, people wouldn't spend billions of dollars trying to prevent you from voting.
Both Louise Wilkerson and Alonza Patrick believe their votes matter, but they worry that some older Black voters will be discouraged. Patrick is also concerned that young Black people who have been marching to save Black lives won't take that same energy to the polls.
I'm hoping that a lot of young folks out there marching, that's going to encourage them to register before and cast a vote.
Still, many Black voters are optimistic about the upcoming election and hope what can be a difficult experience will not stop Black people from voting. I'm Andrea Henderson, St. Louis Public Radio.
And this is for you too, Gus. Are you going to take this vaccination?
We don't just need a coronavirus vaccine. We need that vaccine to be safe to take. The Trump administration launched Operation Warp Speed in the spring to fast-track a coronavirus vaccine, and the fast-track part made some people nervous. Now a group of Black doctors say they will independently vet clinical trial data and decisions by the Food and Drug Administration, which of course approves vaccines. The FDA has been facing some criticism that politics, not science, are guiding its decisions. Dr. Leon McDougall is the president of the National Medical Association, one of the doctors who plans to do this vetting. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Noel.
Dr. McDougall, let me ask you how this works. Whose data are you vetting? Are you getting it from the drug companies that are trying to create vaccines? Are you getting it from the FDA?
So there are a number of sources of information, one being information that's publicly available. However, you need to know what website link to refer to. And with our discussion yesterday morning with General Perna and Dr. Slawi, myself made that a point of concern in regards to the data. For example, Moderna and Pfizer on their website concerning the clinical trials, they're listing the number of people enrolled in the phase 3 trials, along with the demographic makeup of those persons enrolled, we're advocating for having a centralized site on the Operation Warp Speed web page. So it's a one source, and it shouldn't just be the black doctors being able to see what information is being revealed with the clinical studies. Transparency is the word of the day. So the public should be able to see this information. Also, we have members of our task force who are on the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, the Infectious Disease Society of America, the Pediatric Infectious Disease Society, and the CDC Health Equity Work Group. And they also have access to some of the outcomes and enrollment data as it pertains to the clinical trial. So it will be a combination of sources in combination with determinations that are being made. For example, most recently, the Food and Drug Administration stated that they would add a two-month requirement at the administration, after the administration of the second dose of the vaccine, that two-month period for observation would be required before the pharmaceutical company would be able to apply for emergency use authorization. So
FDA has said that they're going to make it, they have said this week, in fact, that they're going to make it the timeline for approval longer. They will make it more difficult, and difficult, but they're going to make stricter
guidelines.
Here's
the issue. Most recently, the administration executive branch rebutted that. So there again, that's where one needs an independent, nonpartisan group being able to make provide input to inform the community.
Dr. Leon McDougall, president of the National Medical Association, thank you so much for your time this morning. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Justice, departs. She was tiny in stature, but she ended her life as an icon and a giant in the law. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, born in 1933 in Brooklyn, began her life parenthesized by the shadow of death, for her sister died in her childhood, and her mother died of cancer on the eve of her high school graduation when she was but 17. When she went on to law school at Harvard, she graduated at the top of her class, one of only 9 female students amongst the student body of 500. Like many women, she couldn't get work at law firms despite her evident abilities. So she taught at law schools and later joined the ACLU, where she took on sexual discrimination cases, a field she knew all too well. And while law firms didn't provide a place for her, the women's rights movement did. She took cases and racked up a record of wins, some before the Supreme Court, where she would even eventually sit at 60 years old. Her hard work as a justice endeared her to a generation of young women, some who took to calling her Notorious RBG, a play on the late Brooklyn rapper B.I.G. When she recently passed due to cancer at 87 years of age, a dam of love and admiration burst through, something rarely, if ever, seen by the passing of a judge. She was more than a judge. She was a star, a cultural icon, a symbol, a shatterer of the idols of white male supremacy. RBG, indeed. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg lies in repose today and tomorrow at the U.S. Supreme Court building. And on Friday, she will lie in state at the U.S. Capitol. She is the first woman ever to be given this honor. All this week, we've been looking back at the life and legacy of Justice Ginsburg, and we'll continue that today. In 1993, when President Bill Clinton nominated Justice Ginsburg to the Supreme Court, he referred to her as, quote, the Thurgood Marshall of gender equality law. But Ginsburg herself sometimes pushed back on the comparison to Marshall and his trailblazing civil rights work.
I'll take this opportunity to say I don't like the comparison of me to Thurgood Marshall, because my life was never in danger. His was. He went to his southern town in the morning. He couldn't be sure he'd be alive at the end of the day. I never had that kind of threat.
That was Justice Ginsburg speaking in 2018. While much of Ginsburg's legal work indicated clear understandings of racial discrimination, some critics have called out some of her more personal shortcomings when it came to race. For example, like most of her male colleagues on the bench, she hired few law clerks who were black or people of color. Joining me now is Fatima Goss Graves, president of the National Women's Law Center. Fatima, thanks for being with me.
Glad to be with you.
So how did racial equality factor into some of Justice Ginsburg's early legal work?
One of the things that I think few people know is when she was at the ACLU Women's Rights Project, she actually filed a really important brief in the court in a case involving whether or not there should be the death penalty for rape. And she really used that case and that brief to highlight both the race tropes around sexual violence for black men, and also the way in which notions of purity that have been attached to white women, that they actually are harmful to white women and to everyone. And so, you know, one of the things that I think may seem more quiet and subtle about her work is that she got pretty clearly the idea that we were all harmed by discrimination. We were all harmed by whatever form it took, whether it was racism, sexism, disability discrimination. That is a through line throughout her work.
And yesterday on the show, well, we've been unpacking her legacy all week this week, and yesterday we talked a little bit about how she became a pop culture icon in a lot of ways, and some of that was really because of her dissent in the 2013 Shelby County case, which effectively dismantled key parts of the Voting Rights Act. Why do you think, Fatima, that dissent struck such a chord?
So the dissent was important for a couple of reasons. It was important because of the terms that she used to highlight the absurdity of the majority's opinion, the absurdity of making it so the Voting Rights Act lost its teeth, right? And she was sort of funny in that opinion. She used analogies and said, you know, if it is raining and you are dry because you have an umbrella, now is not the time to take away your umbrella. It is still raining. And so I actually think one of the things that is very relatable about her opinions is that she goes back to the reality of people's lives, the ways things work in the real world. And for that, I think people thought, wow, she's standing up for everyone, and the cultural work continued forward.
So there have been some critiques, and of course no one is able to get away without having a record critique, particularly if you're a Supreme Court justice. That comes with the territory. But I wonder, Fatima, if you can tell us a little bit about, you know, how we should be looking at the standards, I think, that many, quote-unquote, progressive icons are held to. Some folks have criticized her for not hiring enough black law clerks, for example. She called Colin Kaepernick's decision to take a knee, quote-unquote, dumb, which she later apologized for. So were these human error, or, you know, sort of missteps, or were they part of a larger impossible standard that a lot of our progressive icons are held to?
You know, I think it's important to separate the Kaepernick from the hiring, because I think she apologized once she learned more, right? And that was important. Once she understood what the protest was about and why it was happening, she basically said, I shouldn't have commented. I didn't know enough. My apologies there. But on the hiring front, that is a thing that I think we have to explore and talk about. The Supreme Court bar is a bar that remains still in 2020, mostly white, mostly male, and the sort of elite echelons of the legal profession, clerkships being one of them, there are very few people of color that do clerk, let alone black people who do clerk. You know, when I 20 years ago, when I clerked in the Seventh Circuit, I was one of two black clerks on the whole court at that time. And you would think that it had gotten dramatically better, and that is not the case. So some of that deals with the diversity of the people who are in those roles, but some of it deals with breaking up the sort of systems that make it so only a few people even get close to having that sort of opportunity. It's bad for this country.
When we look at how race has played out on the Supreme Court itself, we know that there are only two people of color, one black sitting judge and one Puerto Rican sitting Supreme Court justice right now, and that is Sonia Sotomayor at the moment. And she has, in many of her opinions at least, directly called out race, including at one point calling out microaggressions in some of her dissents. So will Sonia Sotomayor, Justice Sotomayor, be sort of carrying the mantle further for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, or is she really carving out her own path when it comes to calling out America, the United States' systemic racial inequities here as a justice of color?
You know, I think Justice Sotomayor's role on the bench highlights why we need a really diverse bench, because she raises issues that aren't raised. That is true on race. That is true on gender. And that is true because she can talk about the community she came from, the experiences she's had in her life. But one of the things that she also has done is she has remained connected to community. When she wrote her book, she had meetings where she sort of talked about her life and her personal story. The Supreme Court shouldn't be in an ivory tower making decisions and totally disconnected from real people. And it gives me great confidence that she is on the court.
And now there are many calls to have a black woman as the nominee for the next Supreme Court justice. Fatima, we've got less than a minute to go, but is that even a likelihood if say, Joe Biden wins the presidency?
Well, Joe Biden has committed to appointing a black woman to the Supreme Court, so my guess is that will happen if he wins. But I just want to add that it is this current process for Justice Ginsburg's seat is far, far from done. It is an extraordinary idea that during an election that they would rush this nomination through, and I think people are going to rise up and try to stop this current process as well.
We're already seeing some of that in some key Senate races across the country. Fatima Goss-Graves is the president of the National Women's Law Center. Thank you so much, Fatima.
Thank you.
Damn you, Obama.
We have one perspective this morning on the fight to replace the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. President Trump has talked of nominating someone this week, even as an election looms. Now, in 2016, you'll recall, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell blocked confirming President Obama's nominee before an election, saying, quote, "The American people should have a voice," McConnell's words. In 2020, McConnell offers an elaborate rationalization for insisting on the opposite principle. Adam White is a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and a professor at George Mason University Law School. He's on Skype and has been warning that McConnell's court's great danger. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Aren't you somebody who is likely to favor President Trump's nominee, whoever it is?
Well, definitely. I think he's done a great job on judges so far.
And if it's somebody like Amy Coney Barrett, who is one of the possible nominees, you'd be in favor of that?
She'd be tremendous. I think she'd be an ideal justice.
With that said, you're saying that there is a problem here. What is it?
Well, I think the problem is one that's pretty obvious at this point. Republican senators are going against something that they said very loudly in 2016, namely, there should not be a vote during an election year. I understand that the circumstances are different. I understand that they refer to that from time to time, but I think this goes against the clear thrust of what they said last time. They should delay the vote until after the election.
Let me look at this from a question of raw power, though. What is true in both 2016 and 2020 is that Mitch McConnell, as Senate Republican leader, has the power, assuming he keeps his majority together. He had the power in 2016 to block a nominee he didn't like. Now he has the power to approve one that he likes. Why shouldn't he use the power?
Well, he certainly has the power. In fact, in 2004, I wrote a Law Review article arguing that the Senate does not have to vote on Supreme Court nominations. That's always been true. But I think that in addition to power, senators need to exercise prudence. And at such a precipitous moment in American politics, we should wait until at least after the election to vote or to try to come up with some sort of compromise that handles both the vacancy and the court packing issue.
Well, when you talk about needing prudence, talk me through the dangers here. Suppose Republicans disregard the principle they themselves laid down in 2016 and quickly confirm a nominee before the election. What could possibly go wrong after that?
Well, to be clear, it could go right. I mean, the public might just support the nomination. I think if they wait until after the election and Trump wins, this all becomes a moot point. If they don't wait, though, and Trump loses, there's going to be real questions about the circumstances in which the Senate confirmed this nomination. I think that the senators should wait until after the vote to take stock of the situation and also to take their time in vetting the nominee. This won't take many months, but it'll take more than 1 month, and it ought to be done right. And then they can settle this after the election.
Oh, you raised two interesting points. One is that it's a lifetime appointment, and it usually does take a while. It's not usually done in a few weeks. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that you raise in an article that you've written about this is the possibility of Democratic retaliation, a Democratic response. Haven't some Democrats, not top Democrats, but some Democrats already begun talking about adding justices to the court if they're able to do so after the election?
They have, and I want to be very clear. I think that would be ruinous. I think it would be unjustified. But they are making that threat. And so if we get to a point after the election, if President Trump has lost, I think that moderate senators ought to really consider a way to settle both this vacancy and the court packing plan. Make some sort of deal that avoids the real disaster of court packing.
Could you describe to me how a deal could possibly take place in this partisan atmosphere?
Well, maybe I'm being naive. We've had deals over these sorts of things before. Over a decade ago, the Gang of 14 deal avoided or ended the original judicial filibusters of President George W. Bush's nominations. I think that if we get into November and December and we have a president-elect Biden, I think that Republican senators, Democratic senators will need to really think hard. Do we want to vote on this nomination and then step forward and also have Democrats vote on court packing? Or is there some way that we can reach agreement and avoid what I think would be a catastrophe, a generational catastrophe of a court packing plan?
Is there some fundamental change that is needed here, some constitutional or legal change, ending lifetime appointments to the Supreme Court, for example, just doing something so that the stakes don't seem quite so extreme with every single nomination?
I think that is increasingly a good idea. I didn't think so before, but now I do. I also think this entire controversy reflects the fact that the Supreme Court plays too great of a role in our politics and that the justices themselves need to back away from the powers that they've been asserting over the last 40 years.
Mr. White, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Adam White is a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and a professor of law at George Mason University, Antonin Scalia School of Law. He joined us by Skype.
What role do race and age play in who gets the death penalty? The Justice Department plans to execute Christopher Villalva on September 24th. He's a black man who murdered two white people when he was a teenager. His lawyers say he is characteristic of most inmates on federal death row, and that's a problem. Here's NPR National Justice Correspondent Kerry Johnson.
In 1999, Christopher Villalva hitched a ride with a married couple visiting West Texas for a church revival meeting. Authorities later found the bodies of Todd and Stacy Bagley in the trunk of their car. Todd Bagley died of a gunshot wound. Stacy Bagley died of smoke inhalation after the car was set on fire. 20 years after he was convicted of that brutal crime, Viave is scheduled to face lethal injection. Susan Otto is his lawyer.
He's black. He committed his crime before his brain was fully developed. He's now 40 years old. He's been on death row for longer than he was alive in the free world.
Viave is not claiming he's innocent. Instead, his case resembles most of those that end in the death house in Indiana. Like Viave, who was 19 when he killed the Bagleys, one in four of the men on federal death row committed their crimes before they reached the age of 21. And of the 57 people on the row, more than half are people of color. Sam Spital is director of litigation at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund.
There have been over 500 cases between 1988 and now where the Attorney General of the United States authorized federal prosecutors to seek death. And in over two-thirds of those cases, the defendant was either black or Latinx. And in only about a quarter of the cases was the defendant white.
Spital says the race of the victim also matters a lot. Defendants who kill white people are 17 times more likely to be executed. He says those disparities exist in both the state system and the federal system.
This is a prime example of how the federal death penalty is replicating all of the unconstitutional and discriminatory flaws in the state system.
Susan Otto says she once believed the federal system, which guarantees multiple lawyers for the accused, represented a gold standard. Then she took on the Viave case. When Otto got his case file in 2003, she remembers her reaction.
I was absolutely stunned when I started reviewing the records, and the things that I saw that had gone wrong were shocking to me.
Otto says the problems began with Viave's lawyers back at the time of trial.
The rules are set up to ensure that people who are charged with federal capital crimes receive highly qualified counsel. One of them has to be what's called learned in the law.
The learned counsel in Viave's case was applying for a job at the time in the same office as the people trying to put Viave to death. Later, that man went on to win the job as a federal prosecutor in Texas. That's what Viave's new lawyers call a clear conflict of interest. When they protested years later to the trial judge, Judge Smith, he rejected their appeal and limited the legal arguments they could make to higher courts.
A couple of years after that, we discovered that Judge Smith, in 1998 and continuing forward, had been suffering under some rather acute symptoms of alcoholism.
The judge was suspended from cases for a year, but appeals courts weren't convinced that the judge's problems played any role in the Viave case. That leaves him with no options.
I tell you that this case has shaken my faith in some of the principles that I have believed in and practiced.
Former prosecutor Cully Stimson says his sympathy goes out to victims of these crimes and their families.
It's justice delayed, but it's about time.
Stimson is a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He points out that federal prosecutors who seek capital punishment undergo multiple layers of review inside the Justice Department, and that most defendants get access to ethical and competent lawyers once they reach the courts.
Until Congress eliminates the death penalty for select crimes and states abolish it, we're going to have it for a small number of cases where the punishment is deserved in the eyes of many juries.
Stimson says capital punishment is reserved for a tiny fraction of defendants until Congress decides otherwise. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Ohio-based Persistent Surveillance Systems wants to bring its technology to St. Louis. Last October, CEO Ross McNutt joined us on St. Louis on the Air to explain the system and its origins, which are in war-torn Iraq.
We were losing the war in Iraq as we were losing hundreds of soldiers and civilians to roadside bombs. And the idea was that we would be able to take an image of a city, Fallujah, Ramadi, and be able to watch the explosion occur, go back in time to watch who was there at the before the event, follow them from the explosion back to the houses that they went to and backwards in time to the houses that they came from in order to provide information that would allow you to figure out who exactly planted those. It's the same sort of thing we do with murders and shootings and other sorts of things. By providing the locations where people came from and went to before and after the murder, you're able to identify and provide information to investigators that will help solve those crimes.
Now, CEO Ross McNutt described persistent surveillance systems as, quote, Google Earth with TiVo capability, and it would be free to St. Louis thanks to a benefactor hoping to see the technology deployed in American cities. Now, that proposal is still on the table, and aldermen have urged Mayor Lyda Crewson to open discussions with McNutt's company, even as activists have raised some serious concerns about privacy in the surveillance system. But since we spoke to McNutt, there have been some developments. Namely, last April, Baltimore began a six-month pilot program with persistent surveillance systems. And joining us today is a reporter who's done more than just about anyone to cover its implementation in Baltimore. Joanne Cavanaugh Simpson is a contributor to Baltimore Magazine and also an author, Pulitzer Center 2020 fellow, and a university lecturer. So, Joanne Cavanaugh Simpson, welcome.
Hi, Sarah. It's a pleasure to be here.
You reported that planes have been flying over Baltimore for up to 11 hours a day, capturing these surveillance images. What results have they gotten when it comes to solving crime?
Well, the data is mixed so far. The police department themselves say there's not sufficient data to say whether it's effective or not. They did come out with a recent midterm report that looked at some recent closures with arrests of cases. And they did basically understand that there perhaps a slight increase in closures when the AIR, which is basically what they call the Aerial Investigation Research Project, is found. And so that would say they compared it, maybe 17% of cases were closed that had that that sort of data, aerial data, compared to 14%. But there's some questions about whether it's daytime data versus nighttime, whether it's inside the coverage area or outside the coverage area. So that's all still in process currently.
So this has been underway since April. It feels like we would have thought by now we'd have more clear-cut evidence of this has solved this murder, or we can point to this person caught red-handed here. They're not making those sort of claims at this point. Any sense of what's taking so long to get this thing implemented?
Well, partly it's a tool. It's a complicated tool. And one thing it seems to offer is that it adds to the toolbox, investigators' mm-hmm. toolbox. So it takes a long time for a department, apparently, to get up to speed on the complex nature of the technology. They have to work with, they're kind of basically integrating their other technologies, including CCTV cameras, license plate readers, et cetera. So I think that's part of why it's taking longer. Also, there's just so much crime in the city. It's hard to tell, like for that 17% versus 14%, there's about 19 cases that used the aerial data versus out of 107 versus 124 cases out of 874 cases. So there are many, many more cases out there that are also getting solved. And sometimes they're at night, sometimes. So all of that is being sussed out by the police department and some third-party evaluators that are looking at the data.
So this is not just as simple as, say, using TiVo. It sounds like there's manpower involved. People have to learn the ropes of what they've even got there. And then they've got a lot of their normal stuff they're doing on top of trying to learn this system. Is that kind of a summary of where we're at?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. That's what Police Commissioner Harrison had discussed with me. And also, it's not necessarily a deterrent so far. The homicide rates in Baltimore, which, as you probably know, are very high, are just as high as they have been the previous year. And around Labor Day, the weeks around that, there were 46 shootings of people, and 12 of those died, or that might have included a stabbing in there. But so that's one of the things that's promoted by persistent surveillance systems is deterrence, and that we're not seeing.
Now that's interesting, and that leads right into something I wanted to ask you about. You had described this pilot in Baltimore as a, quote, reboot of the secretive 2016 surveillance collaboration between an embattled Baltimore police department and this private Ohio-based company. Now, this one back in 2016, they started collaborating without residents' knowledge. And when I spoke to CEO Ross McNutt last fall, he said that city officials were the ones who insisted this program begin in secrecy. And when it became public knowledge, it drew some major pushback. And he acknowledged to us that, yeah, the people of Baltimore were upset about this.
And so were we, because to be honest with you, we wanted it to be very public. Two-thirds of what we hope to do is deter people from committing crime in the first place. We reduce crime in a number of different ways. One, we help solve otherwise unsolvable crimes. By doing that, we remove the repeat offenders earlier in their criminal careers. We want to stop someone after they shoot their first person, not after they shoot their 10th or 11th. Mm-hmm. That saves a lot of people. But more importantly, by solving those crimes, the goal is to deter people from committing crimes in the first place. And there's no way to deter somebody if they don't know that you're there. Mm-hmm. So we want to be very public. We want everyone to know that we're there.
And that is CEO Ross McNutt. So this time around, they have been very public. People are on notice that these cameras are flying. How do people feel about that in Baltimore?
Well, first I want to say it's a little bit unclear who wanted it to be undisclosed back in 2016. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there were some communications between the police commissioner then and City Hall. No, they weren't actually going forward and with Ross McNutt's participation. As far as now, yes, it's been very public, and the community, it's mixed feelings, I'd say. A number of people don't appreciate the constant surveillance. The plane is in the air 12 hours a day, pretty much every day, up to 12 hours a day. There have been some complaints, 40 of 60 or 70 complaints have been related to noise, which partly is because these planes are fairly large Cessnas, and sometimes they fly very low, even though they're supposed to fly at 8,000 feet. Hmm. But I think it's more that it's a consistent reminder of the surveillance. And there's been some support. There was a poll back in October done by a local pastor that said that 70% of 500 residents supported this. But then there's been some questions about whether that poll was biased or backed by people who support the plane program itself. Hmm. I think the bottom line with this is that there's a great deal of crime, as you know, violent crime in Baltimore, and there's a great deal of concern over that. So people, both the leaders and the community, there are a lot of people that feel rather desperate about finding ways to address this. And that's actually part of the criticism, is that this outside company is coming in to a community that feels like this, so it's desperate to try something, and there have been some concerns about that.
Yeah, I think there might be some parallels to St. Louis there. We certainly also have these issues, and there's also a mood from some residents that this is an act of desperation by the city to even continue this. We actually heard from some of our listeners today. Brandon writes on our St. Louis on the Air Facebook page, there are large segments of the population that don't trust law enforcement as it is. Spy planes monitoring everyone at all times is not a way to enhance that trust. There are some major Fourth Amendment issues at play. Enhancing the police state is not going to reduce crime. Investment in communities will. Eric writes on Facebook, plenty of potential, of course, but frightening step furthering data ownership questions and a move towards Big Brother. Joanne, I know there have been some court challenges to this Baltimore program, namely from the ACLU. What are they arguing here?
Well, the ACLU initially filed a complaint for a preliminary injunction to stop the planes from going up. And their concern is just that the constant aerial, warrantless, you know, suspicionless mass surveillance violates the First and Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. So that's what they've been arguing, and you know they filed the complaint on behalf of local advocates and community activists and civil rights activists, and their concern is just what you've said, that this first of all might chill their expression of First Amendment. Some have been followed from protests by police in the past. Hmm. They feel like this is one other tool to do that, or somehow make it more difficult, or they feel less comfortable going out on streets to reach out to people when they know that they are being recorded from above. Hmm. So that's what the ACLU is fighting. And then there was just recently, so they appealed the decision. A judge decided to let the program go forward, and they recently filed appeal, and those oral arguments were heard just about a week ago. And they're also arguing that it still violates this, that it that being a constant feature just sort of goes over the line of surveillance, whereas the police have said, well, this is public streets. It's not necessarily, you know, you shouldn't have an expectation of privacy in public streets. But I think the ACLU counters, again, that this goes too far.
So you said there were oral arguments last week. Do we know yet which way the court is ruling or will rule?
We don't. I've been following that to see when that comes out. There were three judges. They had very conflicting opinions based on their answers so far. I mean, you know, you don't know exactly what the opinion will be.
Sure.
But one of them was quite questioning the program. The other two weren't sure that it was a violation just based on their questions or at least their statements. So that should come out fairly soon, but we don't have a date yet.
Okay. And you raised the question in one of your pieces for Baltimore Magazine of whether this technology is being used to surveil protesters. Do we have any evidence at this point that the police are using these images in that way?
Well, the police say they are not using these images in that way. What I did was look at, there's publicly available flight radar data that's based on FAA data, and I look closely at the flight paths over the first half of the program and found that I don't know if it's a coincidence, but they were over the protests on those major protest days.
Hmm.
Now, those protests are within the area that the surveillance plane, there was one plane at the time, mostly cover, but I noticed on the first day when the protests started, the plane seemed to shift from a further western part of that coverage area over to where the protests were. So, you know, the police don't always dictate day-to-day where the plane goes. They just say, these are your coverage areas. So whether the company said, oh, let's go over here, let's shift over here because things are happening, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
That's not clear. So the way we reported was that it's really the point is that it's mass surveillance of anyone that goes down there. I mean, I went down to report on it, and I know that I was in that coverage area that you could see where my dot was, you know, going from my car down to where the protest started.
And after the fact, somebody could use that TiVo function and go back and see where you went after that.
Yes, pretty much. If I'm within the city limits and in the coverage area, yes.
It is. Boy, it just raises just a host of questions here. We also heard from a listener, Jerry, and he had two questions. He wants to know, how is PSS monetizing the data they're collecting in Baltimore? And aside from local law enforcement, who else has access to the data as it's gathered? And subsequently, you could see in the wrong hands, this data could be used for all sorts of things. Does Baltimore have any assurances on who's allowed to see this and whether or not it's allowed to be monetized?
Yes, that was raised in there. They have a contract. They call it a memorandum of understanding. So they have a contract with PSS, and that is part of the contract is that they will not share their data.
Mm.
And that was, you know, with third parties. So the police have access. They will, once they create evidence packets, defense attorneys can get access to that data.
Sure.
But it's apparently pretty limited. That's part of the what the Baltimore Police Department describes as privacy controls. They, you know, there's questions. Not all of this isn't fully transparent because this is a private company doing this work. It's being funded by an outside entity, Arnold Ventures. So, you know, trying to do a public information request on all of the data is not as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's private. Now, once it goes to the courts, they'll be there. But that's still how this all plays out, still questionable.
I want to be a cop.
Two Louisville police officers were shot last night. Police say they do have a suspect in custody and that the officers' injuries are not life-threatening. This happened during protests demanding justice for Breonna Taylor. Yesterday, a grand jury declined to charge two officers who shot at Taylor in her home. A third officer was charged with first-degree wanton endangerment of her neighbors. That officer, who has been dismissed, shot into nearby apartments. Police broke through Taylor's door in what they said was a late-night drug raid. Her boyfriend, thinking they were intruders, shot at them, and police fired at least 32 shots back, hitting Breonna Taylor 6 times and killing her. There have now been months of protests, including yesterday's. Stephanie Wolf of WFPL was there yesterday. She's with us now. Good morning, Stephanie.
Good morning.
The city set a 9 o'clock p.m. curfew. Not everyone obeyed that curfew. What did you see in the streets yesterday?
Yeah, well, immediately following the announcement, protesters basically marched out of the downtown area, and they were met face-to-face with police, and arrests were made. Much later into the evening, there were small fires set around the Hall of Justice, and about 30 minutes before curfew is when the two officers were shot downtown. Police say one had to undergo surgery, and there were demonstrations that continued after the curfew.
So as you were out yesterday talking to protesters, what were they telling you?
Well, this was not the news protesters were hoping for. A few told me it was insulting, especially that the one officer was indicted for endangering Taylor's neighbors and not for his involvement in her shooting death. I spoke with Louisville-based poet and activist Hannah Drake. She called the results a, quote, joke.
It's just another reminder, as a Black woman, that my life does not matter. It's disappointed. This girl was in her house. She wasn't bothering anybody.
We are hearing a lot of heartbreak there from her and from others. I imagine these protests will continue.
Yeah, I mean, yesterday marked the 119th consecutive day of protest in Louisville, demanding justice for Taylor since late May. And what I repeatedly heard from protesters is that yesterday's announcement will not end the demonstrations. Here's Nicole Williams. She says she'll be out today and the next day.
However many days I will be here. No justice, no peace. And there's still no justice. And until there's justice, there will be no peace. Period.
So last week, the city settled a wrongful death lawsuit by Taylor's family. And as part of that settlement, the city committed to implementing a list of law enforcement reforms, like using a tracking system to flag officers who use excessive force or have citizen complaints. So protesters and residents are waiting for how much substantive change will be put in place now.
Stephanie Wolf with WFPL in Louisville. Stephanie, thanks so much for your reporting on this one. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, September 26th, 2020, so I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have observations, questions, suggestions to share. The number to dial, 720-716-7300. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Whew. Things to get to before we get to the callers. We will be here, I think, Monday and Wednesday of this coming week. We should have whites only policy, context of white supremacy, as I said, definitely for the remainder of this calendar year, and it could be indefinitely. Whites only. We might have, you know, non-white guests from time to time, but it will be irregular. Whites only. Both guests for this coming week, white people, particularly one of them, white. Oh, we did. I was thinking, man, she just had a report on St. Louis Public Radio where they were talking about words, and they were specifically talking about one of the ways that racism, white supremacy is practiced, is that we will, white people, will stigmatize the way that non-white people, the way that we speak, or if we're not speaking in precise what they call King's English, that sort of thing. But there are so many different components to language and white supremacy, racism. That's what we'll be talking about with our guest on Wednesday. That's September 30th. Was that the 31st? Let me see. 30th, yeah, right the first time. And then Monday, our guest, he does research climate change, and they've been talking a lot about how areas with lots of non-white people, black people especially, have higher temperatures and don't have as many trees and will have more bus terminals and things of that nature and lots more asphalt things that will hold in all of that heat when you're in the summer months like we just went through. So when you have intense heat like they did in many places, it's even worse. You'll have even higher temperatures, and that's really bad for people's health frequently. Anyway, but they did this map, I guess, for Monday. And he showed that there's a correlation between areas that have high heat, areas that were victims of so-called redlining, when racist man, racist woman, racist child, they restricted where non-white people could live, would not rent to them in certain areas, and charged astronomical prices for really poor, dilapidated housing for non-white people. And this was standard operating procedure across the land, that these areas where black people still reside in many instances, also really bad for heat. No accident, no coincidence. We talked about some of this in A Terrible Thing to Waste, Harriet A. Washington. But that's our guest for Monday. Both white people, looking forward, always grand to be able to question white people. And our book club, rolling right along, Cased, that's Thursday. Isabel Wilkerson, who is a non-white person, victim of racism, cowbell. We are reading Cased, The Origins of Our Discontents. Wow. It would be in the running for worst book ever if it were not for The Hate U Give, Nutricide, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. Not the worst book ever, but it is not very good, not very accurate. We will continue Thursday, segment number four. Cased is not, the book study is not in on SoundCloud. I figure we might get in trouble with white people, but it is in iTunes. It is at Black Talk Radio Network, Blueberry, number of other sites that host the Cows Archives. I posted the iTunes links. Just the other day, someone said that they were, I guess, looking on SoundCloud for the books, book club archives. They are not on SoundCloud. That is deliberate. But they are on iTunes and many other outlets. Feel free to check it out. I know that's a very popular book, unfortunately. It's very sad if anybody is, if that is the first book or one of the first books that they are reading, trying to understand white supremacy, racism in a serious manner. Wow, Cased is a really poor foundation. Book study continues. The segment that was important, I think that was one of the more important things that happened this week. They had that report about the money laundering, and they said trillions with a T, trillions of dollars in illicit transactions and money laundering and drug trafficking profits, and this impacted the stock market. I don't know if people saw that, but like all of this happened right at the beginning part of the week. They said, oh my goodness, we've had this horrible dip in the stock market, had this report about all this money laundering and Supreme Court justice chaos and who's going to be on the bench and all the rest of it. Like, they were, you know, a lot of white people were doing a lot of hand-wringing at the beginning of the week, but I thought that was extremely important for a myriad of reasons, even starting off with, in the report, they called it dirty money. That is in the word guide. Neely Fuller Jr., as soon as I heard it, I said, here we go again, dirty money. So what does Mr. Fuller say about dirt dirty? Avoid using these terms unless you are using them to apply to actual dirt, as on the surface of the earth. Do not use expressions like dirty book, dirty look, dirty talk, dirty money. He doesn't have dirty money in there, but he has etc. Do not say that someone gave you a dirty deal. Reason: the words dirt or dirty have been used by the white supremacists, racists, to often mean the same as dark and evil and dark and filthy or dark and unworthy. White supremacists have often used the words dirt or dirty in such a manner as to associate dirt, dirty, dark, filth, and evil with black, brown, red, yellow, or any non-white people. Thus, according to many white supremacists, the word dark, dirty, and evil all mean the same, particularly when applied to non-white people. Note, it is important to study the ways that people use the words dirt or dirty when someone uses terms like dirty words, dirty talk, dirty money. Ask him or her if he or she means incorrect words or incorrect talk. Ask him or her why he or she uses the word dirty in that manner. ProduceJustice.com if you need a word guide. But trillions in dirty money. Now, you hold on to that piece, right? Trillions, they say. And then you go to one of the final reports that we heard. Got a pilot program in Baltimore. Got a Cessna. I don't remember that. What was the TV show? I didn't watch it. That was so popular that everyone talks about for Baltimore, and it's got all the Negros selling drugs and all that. I'm sure it's on Netflix or what have you, but I never watched it. Have not seen one episode. But people, I watched that show. Anyway, I don't know if they had the plane flying over for 12 hours to solve crime, but crime is so bad, and we're so concerned about the black lives. See, black lives matter. That they had a benefactor. In fact, did you hear that? They said, we got a benefactor who wants to pay the budget for the plane. We're in the middle of the Rona crisis. They didn't say we had a benefactor who wanted to make sure all little children had tablets, iPads, Wi-Fi, so that they can get their lesson, get their grammar, read The Hate U Give, new American classic. No. We got a benefactor to get a Cessna plane to hover over your city for 12 hours a day. And then we can use the function like TiVo to rewind and track where you've been. And this will allegedly help us solve crime or track protesters. Maybe the same thing. Trillions in dirty money. Is the Cessna, can we do anything about that? Can the Cessna go over and find, you know, the money laundering white people and drug trafficking white people and trillion? I mean, that's a big deal, right? That's a major problem. The Cessna can't do anything about it? No. Michael Brown Jr., who strong arm robbery for a pack of cigarillos. Oh yeah, we got a Cessna plane. We get that taken care of right now. Priorities in the system of white supremacy, racism, and even allocation of resources. They said this plane started out, they were tracking the insurgents. My man Chris Kyle, American Sniper, they were using this in Iraq, right? That's what they said. And that same technology got the same problem with Negroes in Baltimore. Yes, we'll use the same technology here, and then we'll bring it to Ferguson. Yes, Michael Brown Jr., he's an insurgent too. Yes. Again, now can you imagine that sort of technology being employed? What do we got? We got the opioid crisis, right? White people, all that. Can we use it to stop all of that? No? No? Okay. benefactor to get black people any other problem solved? Do we have a benefactor to, I don't know, get support so black people could get organic produce? That might be a good one. Can we get that? The tablets, we got the Rona situation. That was a good one. Free Wi-Fi, any of that? No? No? All right. And I'm sure that Cessna plane, again, is green certified. That's not going to have any sort of health impact. No emissions from the plane, not impacting the air quality at all, I am sure. Let's see. The Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, passing away. I find it fascinating in a John Brown kind of way, metaphor, meaning another well-meaning white person, kindly. Maybe she was the benefactor, I don't know. I find it interesting. Just the amount of emphasis on her as a crusader for justice and even explicitly against racism, white supremacy. Mumia Abu-Jamal, who is a victim of white supremacy, he titled his report Justice Leaves, and kind of in a metaphorical sense almost, in talking about the passing of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And I just thought, wow, again, for Mumia Abu-Jamal, he's a victim of white supremacy. I do say, though, consistently, because he is in greater confinement, those could be his views authentically, but I do say he's kind of in a compromised position where he has to be nice to and acknowledge kindly, well-meaning white people. I feel like he has to, because that's kind of, he has such limited resources, such limited options. Again, those might be his authentic views, and he might have said the exact same thing if he were outside of greater confinement. That might be the case, but just something I always think about when I hear his thoughts, views. Anywho, I heard that from a lot of people, even people, even a lot of non-white people who are not in greater confinement, had lots of lofty praise and admiration for Justice Ginsburg this week, and I just find all of that incorrect is really the first word that comes to mind, but puzzling. I can't say puzzled, because the system of white supremacy does a very good job of creating the mythology of kindly white people who are not racist. That program with Zach Casey, The Impossibility of Positive White Identity. We translated that on the program with him as, it is impossible to have a white person who is not racist. Not possible. Even Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And I would just do it in that, like, does she have a really good biography? Maybe we should read that in the book club. Like, let's see her record. What did she do in her time on the planet, her time on the planet and her time on the bench to solve this problem? Or is this going to be another one that's a lot of conflation, where we start off talking about racism and then we end up with her record on LGBTQ issues and white women issues and all the rest of it, and then we get maybe a paragraph on white supremacy racism? It's going to be, let's get a thorough inspection of this record if this is going to be another kindly, well-meaning white person who was allegedly working really, really hard up until her dying day to solve the problem of white supremacy racism. I have suspicion about that for any individual classified as white. Now, historical, future, as long as this system exists. But there's been a lot of that this week. Let's see. With her passing, I do remember 2016, I said that last week when it was President Obama, Justice Scalia passed away in February of 2016. So they went an entire calendar year without having another justice on the bench. And some of the same, they talked about that hypocrisy, some of these same white people. Now, that word again, unprecedented, to see if we can hurry and process a nomination, Supreme Court nomination, in basically 30 days before a U.S. presidential election. Again, unprecedented in U.S. history, if that means anything. All of that, I said, 4 more years. 4 more years, again, if any folks see this as evidence. See there, Trump is doing all this because he doesn't think he's going to secure the win in November. And, you know, if he doesn't do it now, then Biden will be able to select a Supreme Court justice. All right. Or if there are other reasons, if other folks think, you know, it is not looking good, that Trump is not going to be victorious later this fall, please share that view. But I don't think so. If anything, I have heard some folks say that they think this election could be contested, meaning there might be some litigation around it. I said, oh, that would be a good reason to go ahead and pick another judge now. If you think that that is going to happen or could potentially happen, if there's some, you know, conflict about the results or what have you, yes, I'd like to go ahead and pick another justice now, make sure I have this in my favor if there's going to be some, you know, review, judicial review of the final tabulations. Anywho, but I do remember that explicitly and how robust the opposition was when it was a non-white person in the White House who was trying at the beginning of the calendar year, not days before the election, at the beginning of the calendar year, trying to do his constitutional duty and nominate a judge. And it was nearly unanimous. Absolutely not. Get out of here, coon. Let's see. Four more years. The number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. We are listener-supported, counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the cows is constructive. Visit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. If you visit the blog, you will see the American Sniper book club session is posted there. All of the sessions collated into one spot. Thought with everything that has transpired this year, might be a good time to revisit Chris Kyle, American Sniper, armed white man in all his glory, bragging about his kills and such. Might be, you know, worth a, or I guess a listen or a read. If you don't want to listen to the audiobook or what have you, you can just go and check it out. It was a bestseller, made it into a big film that was released on Christmas Day. I had totally forgotten about that was the release date for that major film until I, you know, glanced back at our book club like, oh wow, that The Religion of White Supremacy. But yes, American Sniper, the book club session is on the blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. We are also on Cash App, cash.app/$thecows. Much obliged to all the folks who have invested for 11 years plus, where we covered extraordinary books like American Sniper, The Hate U Give, Cased. Much obliged. I hope the cows has been and continues to be worthy of your time and energy. You can also hit the wish list at Amazon.com under Gus T. Renegade. It is linked on the blog. Huge thank you, gratitude to all of the folks who have nabbed items from the wish list. Again, I hope the cows has been and continues to be worthy of your time and energy. Looking to nab my new computer, so hopefully folks will invest and or have my computer, a computer on the wish list. Having major computer problems, hopefully, will not cause a disruption to my ability to broadcast, but it is definitely time for a computer replacement. Has served me well. Let's see, for this broadcast yesterday, I feel justified, and for all these years now having called attention to metaphors, and for this broadcast specifically saying, hey, let's be really mindful about what we say. We're not just going to use metaphors every other sentence. Let's work to be exact, precise with what it is we want to say. The dirty money, that's a metaphor right there. But even encased, there are a lot of metaphors, and even many of our listeners or readers have pointed out. I haven't even said anything. Many a times it's been our readers who have said, wow, the metaphors are making this book difficult to comprehend, difficult to enjoy. I'm not really certain about what she's saying, and then even unpacking what's being compared. Very, very important as a reader and really as a listener, because it happens so frequently. For this broadcast, if we could take 5 minutes to share our thoughts, observations, that would be grand. Make sure everyone gets at least one chance to speak. And if we could not use those metaphors, similes, analogies, just be direct, literal about what it is that we want to say. I will prompt about the metaphors again. Race soldiers, they are extraordinary at using metaphors to practice deception, comparing things that are not similar at all. We've been exposed to this misconduct for a long time, and frequently we are still learning. We just haven't come to a conclusion, so we don't have logic to articulate our thoughts. All of that is fine. Just be mindful to not substitute metaphors for logic, evidence. Much obliged. If you could use your mute button, that would be helpful. If you know you're in a loud place, maybe they're watching the game or, you know, whatever it is, just use your mute button when you're not speaking, and then when you're ready to talk, unmute yourself. Hopefully you can find kind of a somewhat quiet area. With that, let's see. First few folks, *61 if you have commentary to share. First few folks with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello? Hello?
Greetings, Irie.
Greetings, everybody. Greetings, Steph. Hotep. I'm going to make it short. So the segment on the neurology, I was actually with my mother, who was able to hear it a little bit, and I thought that was good timing, because she just had a neurological exam, and she's having problems with her cognition and short-term memory, and she also interrupts a lot when people are talking, and they tested her, and they said she was normal. And I was like, this can't be. Like, that's not normal for you not to remember something that happened, like, less than 5 minutes ago. It's not normal to not be able to, you know, have control over, you know, your speech. And it's, that's not right. And then I put two and two together on a call-in show. I guess it was last weekend or another weekend before, where the NFL said some guy that had a traumatic brain injury, that he was, they said that was normal, or that he wasn't so smart in the first place. So they disagreed with the ruling. So I was like, you know, I said, I think they tested you with a lower baseline, you know, from the start. They're saying that you're not, you know, you're low level in the first place. So that would be normal for a low-level person. And the doctor that tested her was a white female and a non-white, I suspect white-identifying so-called Indian doctor. And I've seen Indian doctors mistreat me, so I figured it was the same thing. But, yeah, makes sense. You know, there's not many non-white black people in the field. You know, the patients are being mistreated, and doctors in the field are, you know, being left out, and that's on purpose. In regard to the swastika, I feel like actually the most racist symbol known to mankind may be the Christian cross. Because look at how they use it. They're not burning swastikas in people's front yards. They're burning crosses. And based on what I know about the cross, from studying about ancient Kemet, they altered the Kemetic symbol of the Ankh
and made it into what's now known as the Christian cross. So, yeah, I'm not surprised that they defiled an Eastern symbol as well. But the most racist, again, that's BGQ to me. I think the most racist symbol known to mankind is the cross. What else? And that's just one other thing I want to say about white supremacy is a sickness. I think that that's a metaphor. And I want to say that white supremacy isn't a sickness. It just is what it is. And if we use logic, how many people do you know actually want to be sick? People don't want to be sick. They want to be treated for the sickness that's not cured altogether. So to say white supremacy is a sickness is to say that we have a bunch of people around identifying as white that want to have a malady, you know, they're fine with it, and they don't want to do nothing about it. No, it just is what it is, and that's it. And we just have to figure out what are we going to do from there, because we don't have the power to change it, and they're not willing to change it. And we can't keep going through these motions that we're going through, you know, protesting and this and that. And sorry, I'm not trying to be nebulous, but it's not a sickness. It's just a fact. And that's all I wanted to share for now. Everybody have a great night.
Much obliged, Ari. Let's see. Be mindful of what we say. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Have we heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, guys. Greetings to all the callers and the listeners. This is in Yame in Nebraska. I just wanted to offer a few observations from an experience that I've had the past couple of days. I took something you said into consideration from the last time I called regarding the whole Cops Accountable initiative that they've been holding here in Lincoln, Nebraska. I decided to continue participating in the forums, but I'm also on a subcommittee that overlooks the policies and their attempt to make changes that will make it more difficult for law enforcement officers to escape accountability. There is a white woman who is on the subcommittee policy. She's older, about maybe in her 60s. I haven't asked her age, but I estimate that to be around how old she is. And she reminds me of Peggy McIntosh in the way she speaks, the level of refinement in her racism. And I haven't had a chance to ask her if she's heard of Peggy McIntosh. But she has... I really don't know what to think of it, because she's during the forums, during one of the policy subcommittee meetings, we had one of the law enforcement agents of the city department come in and give his perspective from a law enforcement point of view on some of the proposed changes we were making to the policy. And this was the day following the trip Donald Trump took to Kenosha, Wisconsin, where he made statements about people throwing cans of soup at law enforcement officials there, and he implied that those cans were weapons. What she did was, during the meeting, she came in with a bucket of canned vegetables and soups, and she brought up that moment in Donald Trump's speech when he said, and then she handed him the bucket of cans. But this recent meeting, at the end of the meeting, she spoke last, and we were sitting there with the assistant chief of police and a few other officers there, or law enforcement officials there. And she was talking at first about a thin blue line. I'm not sure what she meant. Then she talked about the lines between black and white. And she stood up. She stood up at first, then she sat back down. And when she mentioned the line between black and white, she threw a bullet onto the floor. We were sitting in a circle. She threw the bullet onto the floor. And I thought that was quite, I thought that was quite interesting that she would do that. But, I think no one seemed to bat an eye at it, I think she's well aware of her position in a system of racism, and for her to take those opportunities to exert those types of symbolisms. But after the meeting, she comes, prior to this, she came to me and asked me if she ever says anything that's too white, could I please let her know? But she doesn't know that I made it part of my code not to help white people. But this last time we spoke after this meeting with the bullet incident, she walked up to me and another non-white black female who were conversing. And she asked, why is it that we never really speak about other groups' racism? And we asked for clarification of what she meant. And she is basically implying that non-white people could be racist. But she, at first, my response was, I don't think we have the power to be racist. I mean, based on the system of white supremacy, the only ones who could be racist are white people. But I thought that's something that we all agreed on before. And then she started asking specifically about Chinese people. And I guess I had to reiterate and remind her of the conversation we had before where she was in agreement. But I just thought that was interesting. And I did get some information of constructive value about the statistics around here, even though the police, the law enforcement officials assert that racism, white supremacy isn't much of a problem here. They also admit that even though black people are 5% of the population, we account for more than 10% of the traffic stops, as well as over 50% of the complaints against law enforcement officials, even though most of those go unsustained. That's all I wanted to share, and thank you for the opportunity, and I'll yield my line.
Much obliged. In Yame in Nebraska, Dr. Peggy McIntosh, a guest on the Cows back in 2009, way back, a suspected race soldier, and actually one of the ways, in my view, that she deliberately practiced white supremacy racism on the broadcast, in my view, was she wrote one thing white people can do to help solve this problem, calling it what it is, white supremacy. Then she came on our broadcast, white privilege, white privilege, white privilege. I know I'm a person with privilege, that type of thing. So, yes, this suspected racist white woman to come out, if any white person asks you, point out ways that I'm racist. She didn't even say point out if I say something racist, if I point out something too white. I don't even know what that means exactly, but same thing I've been saying with Case. We find ways of getting away from saying racism, white supremacy. We'll just call it anything else. Being white, white privilege, being racial, racialist, casteist, all kinds of ways of getting away from, I was just practicing white supremacy racism. Make it plain. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter in Florida.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. One of the most fundamental things that we can engage in as victims of racism, white supremacy, in terms of practicing, attempting to counter racism, is the advent of trying to stay alive in the most healthiest condition that we possibly can, which includes eating as properly as possible, and also codified behavior, which reduces anguish and or anger for as far as mental situations. This week, I actually made a decision before this week, but this week I actually had been preparing myself for a colonoscopy. On Thursday's book reading, I actually was drinking the yummy prep that is designed to clean out one's colon. And it's not yummy. I was just joking about that part, of course. Took the procedure yesterday afternoon. Prior to that, I had never had any surgery. I had never artificially been rendered unconscious. The only unconsciousness that I have ever suffered was running myself into other people on the football field. So I was kind of apprehensive, of course, with the whole process. And just from the standpoint of how many white people are involved, we don't do too well as opposed to relationship in medicine anyway. I was grateful to understand that it was not as complex as I thought it was. Actually, the toughest thing I had to go through was drinking the yummy prep. I was quite fortunate also when I went to the office or the center where the procedures took place. Except for the physician, all of the assistants were non-white black females who were very nice, very professional, and it was like, you know, excuse me, I'm going to use a metaphor. It was a piece of cake. It was very, very satisfying. It's almost like cutting your yard. You don't like to do it, but you feel very good after you have accomplished such a task. I'm pretty sure everybody knows, especially black males, by you doing it, it can save your life. And as I mentioned before, part of one of the most fundamental issues into practicing counter-racism is to preserve your life as long as possible. Because certainly the racist white supremacists have all types of artificial means of killing us well before that time of your means to stop breathing is. They have plenty of different methods, tactics, and strategies to shorten that period of time. And counter-racism is preserving yourself as long as possible. That is actually working to weaken the global system of racist white supremacy, and that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. I had a question really quick just about this beverage. Like, what exactly is it? Is this like a fruity concoction, or like, what do you know what's in it exactly?
I don't know exactly what's in it. It does have a bitter sweet taste, but it will remind you of nothing but something medicine wise. It will remind you of anything like ginger ale or you know something close to your favorite drink. It is actually tough to swallow. I put it for me. I was sipping only to the content of what probably a small animal, how they would sip something because it tastes so bad. And then with the memory, because I had to ingest two of them, 6 ounce bottles. After the first time, because it was new, you know, you were able to get through, but that second time gives you a memory of how bad it tastes the first time. So it's like a struggle. It's like a struggle. And that's what I was doing with the book read, because my first intake was at 5 p.m. and the second intake was at 10 p.m. right during the book read. And it is tough, but afterwards I quickly washed it down with, 2 16-ounce, bottles of water, to get that taste out of my mouth. But what it does, it must be some kind of strong chemical. What it does, it makes you go to the bathroom. It gives you a form of diarrhea, a very extreme form of diarrhea. That's what it does. And that's how you empty everything out of your colon. And, actually it gets to the point to whereas, I put it this way, instead of you urinating out of the correct orifice, your urination becomes from your anus, basically. And actually it gets to the point to whereas the dispersed matter actually looks like water. And what that does, that makes it quote unquote easier for the physician to see what's in your colon. That's the quote unquote logic behind it. But I don't know exactly what's in it. No, I don't.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Health is important. We just talked about that with Dr. Ruby Lathan. She was with us, I think her fifth visit this past Wednesday, and she was talking with Chadwick Boseman. So sad. We were talking about that and revisiting, you know, just ways you can protect your colon and all the fiber. I think she's emphasized that almost every time she's been on the program. It's just saying get more fiber in so you can get to the restroom. Get that fiber. That's one of the ways that you can make sure you are taking care of your health. And I think we heard that drinking more water. So important. She even said, even if you are eating correctly, getting your fiber and fresh fruits and vegetables, all the rest, you got to be drinking water so that you can have those regular healthy bowel movements to get those toxins out of the system. We just talked about that in detail. Dr. Lathan this past Wednesday. Other folks, if you have commentary to share, again, don't wait till the last moment. If you have questions, observations, thoughts, the number 720-716-7300, the code 564-943, pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Speaking of your health, man, the Temptations, I didn't get one of their songs in this week, but Bruce Williamson Jr. passing away at the age of 49, not that long ago. And then this week, Gail Sayers also, passing away. So absolutely in a year, lots of losses, and 49 for Mr. Williamson Jr. Like, man, that's, Chadwick Boseman was only 43. So, That is not supposed to be the time when you're checking out. You should be, you know, a dad with children, doing some parenting and that type of thing. Figure out what you're going to do for the next, I don't know, 20, 30 years of your life and great physical condition and that sort of thing. Not, you know, preparing to not be here anymore. Let's see. Other folks dialed in with a hand up if you have observations. Comments to share. Lines should be open. Proceed. See, folks are spectating a little bit while they get their thoughts together. The metaphor, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and I even paused. I don't do the RBG thing. I think calling her notorious RBG, I think white people do a lot of stealing from non-white people. You can't even come up with your own names. You have to go and get a black person who's died, and we'll take his title and put that on Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Can't even come up with a unique creative name of your own without stealing that from non-white people as well. Just something has always bothered me about that nickname for the former justice. Anywho, but then they said Ruth Bader Ginsburg is the Thurgood Marshall of the bench, of the Supreme Court. And even she said, that Coon Gustie might be a little off with his metaphors, but I am not Thurgood Marshall. And she did exactly what I said. You unpack. What are they saying in the metaphor? Look at the comparison. Same thing. Chris Rock, when he says Ellen DeGeneres is the gay Rosa Parks. Really? She even had to step up. That doesn't change anything for me, but she even had to. No, I am not Thurgood Marshall. There was no point where I was going to die for being a white woman. Thurgood Marshall could have been killed being a black male system of white supremacy. Watch those comparisons. Folks get very, very reckless with their comparisons. And again, even Mumia Abu-Jamali said that victim of white supremacy, VGQ, but white male supremacy is not the problem. Racist man, racist woman, racist child, that is so common where we get off white male supremacy, white male patriarchy. No, you are leaving out about half the equation of the whites who are responsible for this problem. Let's see. Other folks dialed in. They have observations, thoughts to share. Proceed.
Hello, Gus.
I think this is Irie.
Yeah, I just wanted to say real quick, I want to have a quick libation for the late John Coltrane. His birthday was September 23rd, and unfortunately him as well died before he should have at age 42. So just wanted to share that and honor him and his work and his life.
Much obliged, Irie. 42. Lots of black people end up leaving this planet way before they should. Again, that should be part of the motivation. One, keeping, you know, self-care, health, top priority, system of white supremacy, racism, trying to make sure that we eat well, are taking quality care of ourselves. Also, motivation for why we want to solve this problem immediately, not be wasting time, or we'll just continue to have folks. It's because it's not just entertainers. And again, when confused victims of racism, when they say it's class, it's not racism, it's class, you shouldn't see lots of black people who have lots of nickels. It's not like they're poor and stuck having to go to the Dollar General to get food. That's not the case. They can go to Whole Foods and, you know, buy up everything they want, and they still end up with all those same health problems, dying early. Dr. Ruby Latham talked about that on Wednesday. That obesity, you don't just see that with black people who are low income, as they say. You see it with black people who can go out to Whole Foods and ball out of control. Why is that? White supremacy, racism. But making that a motivating factor to solve the problem as soon as possible. Let's see. The other... We're not doing the hangout, people lollygagging until the very end if folks are spectating. So we're going to wrap at 8:30, 8:35 if folks are just hanging out and spectating, even people that have not shared, not waiting just until the end to get 5 minutes and then decide that we want to talk. I'm making sure I get in the commentary about Islam is filth. I heard Thomas in New York as well. Exactly what I've read from Mr. Fuller's Word Guide. Dirt being compared, or it's really equivalent, same thing, to non-white people. That was in the Miami Herald insert. They were called, said, Islam is filth. I think that was exactly in the Word Guide when he had it for defining dirt, dirty, why those terms should not be used. Consistent. Just be mindful, tracking the importance of words, particularly on this broadcast, being mindful of what words we use. Thomas in New York? Yes, sir.
Are you here? Yes, sir. I believe the infamous P. Diddy had a rap group called Dirty Money. They came out with an album. Is there a word in the Word Guide, bloody? I hear bloody money a lot too, and from my observation, blood gets very dark when it dries up. Does he have something in there in regards to bloody?
I cannot reach my Word Guide presently.
Okay.
If we could get an assist, if somebody has a Word Guide for blood money, is that in the Word Guide? If you feel like sharing before we go off the air. If we miss it today, we'll get it next time around, Thomas, in New York.
No problem. Well, President this week announced he's going to give black people the platinum plan. Mind you, I never in my life saw a politician offer to give black people a plan exclusively. In contrast, what does the Democrats do to attract black people? They bring out strippers. Get your booty to the pole commercials with real black female strippers in their G-strings and bikinis, sliding up and down poles, twerking and popping. Informing us how important our vote is, I guess, to them. Keep in mind, they already dragged out ex-stripper rapper Cardi B to get an exclusive interview with Joe Biden. And this week, Michelle Obama is campaigning for Joe Biden on J-Lo's social media feed. And ironically, J-Lo and Cardi B just happened to be in a stripper movie together not too long ago. So I'm like, man, it's a lot of stripper. But back to the platinum plan for blacks. How racist is that? it sounds like if you go to a Trump casino and you get an upgrade to a bigger room with a better bed, you get the platinum plan. I said, man, this guy, Chicago lawmakers and activists want to send children to school with bulletproof backpacks. They even gave them out and gave a tutorial on how to use these bulletproof backpacks that they hear shooting, how to scoot down, and the best way for it to cover the massive amount of your body so it can, your backpack gets the bullets. Who would send their kids to school in a bulletproof backpack? Like, man, all that to say, man, I would think that the police should be walking the beat or something. Like, you have to be able to stop this if you're in charge of the city. You can't have the kids go to school in bulletproof backpacks. That's unreal, but they're really doing it. So they want to kick people off social media. I believe you said that people were saying that the fires in Portland and Seattle
are being caused by people, and they want to kick people off of social media for having a different opinion than what they are saying. I guess what's next? They're going to lock them up. This is all part of the cancel culture. You know, just cancel these people who are having a different opinion. What happens when the conspiracy theory of white supremacy is put up and they say, we don't want you black people to talk about white supremacy. It doesn't exist. We had a black president. They're passing the Breonna Taylor bill. It doesn't exist. And if you talk about it, you're off social media. I mean, like, this is where it's come to. You're supposed to be able to say what you want to say. You can't have a mail-in election in a country with 330 million people and tens of millions of people who are here illegally. How can you verify all these ballots? Like, it's impossible. And everyone knows it. Or both sides know it. Unfortunately, this is their way, as you said earlier, Gus. They want to hold this up on election day. They want it to go to court and somehow legally remove Trump because they know they have no way of beating him. The Democrats lost their ability to contest the judge when they contested Kavanaugh. And they had a contest due to tour of the Republicans blocking Gershit, or whatever his name was, that Obama put out there. Gave the Democrats a block. They tried to use it on Kavanaugh, but lost. So now they have nothing. So lawfully, he can't put anyone there, I think, within 45 days. So Mamiya on Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the notorious RBG, it's like B.I.G., but also RBG, at least here in Harlem on 125th Street, that's the name of the people who wear the red, black, and green, black power people. He's in prison praising a racist. The only justice, I looked this up, the only justice to not have one writing on prison reform. Everyone, even Kavanaugh, who just got there, has something on prison reform. And as recently, the Colin Kaepernick thing, where she called him dumb, we didn't see her have to. Now, this would have been, they would have dragged her to the 50-yard line if she had to sit down and have a wine summit with Kaepernick, that, like they did Obama. You know, but this is a system of white supremacy. Surveillance by the government, that's always happened. Now surveillance capitalism has replaced industrial capitalism. The largest companies in the country are Google, Amazon, Apple, Tesla, Facebook, and Microsoft. Your car surveils you more than your phone. Hundreds of sensors in your car knows your weight and your height based off of the seat sensors and tracking the distance to the steering wheel. It knows your temperature. It also can give insurance companies a driving score for you, so they can lower your insurance score now. And when you plug your phone into your car, it knows you're giving them access to everything that's on your phone. So the car is actually one of the most surveilled tools. But Amazon this week, for their new Alexa little box that with the speaker that you talk to, this one has a little drone that fits on the top of it. And if it picks up a sensor from your Ring doorbell, it automatically flies to that area to give you a picture of who's entering your house, or it's an actual product that they're coming out. It's going to be $249.99 coming out sometime next year. And this is where how deep the surveillance is. And remember, Amazon is the number one company for facial recognition in the United States. And also their Ring doorbell program works with law enforcement, so the law enforcement has the right extract if you sign up for the program, so they say. But if they have access to it, if you don't sign up, they could just extract it. How would you know? And I'll meet my line, Gus. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. RBG as well, all the way around. The segment where they talked about race and the death penalty, I was thinking the same thing. Like, I'm not an expert on Ruth Bader Ginsburg and, you know, every opinion that she's written and all the rest. But, I mean, is she ignorant about the impact of racism on black defendants? Like, I thought that case went to the court. Did she have anything to say about that? Was she out staunchly defending black defendants saying, yeah, this is wrong. This is racism, white supremacy. Like, I would love to do some research to see, is this well earned? Like, what has she said exactly to earn all of this praise? Like, it's got to be something. You got to give me something. A paper, a speech, a paragraph in one of her books, something. Like, it can't just be that she was out doing it for white women and white male supremacists. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
How's it going? This is Black Male Engineer. Glad to be back on the program. Just wanted to say that I think I'd said it before, but I officially left my plantation where I was having a lot of problems. I am back in school. I'm at an HBCU, and it feels much better to be in this environment, especially during grad school. So I'm just glad to be back around amongst black people, non-white people in general. In terms of the clips today, I thought one thing that was interesting was the money laundering clip. So, you know, in actuality, Europe is a hub for money laundering. But, you know, when you usually think of money laundering in terms of countries, you usually hear something about African nations, black nations, so-called black nations. And this is actually one of the main things they say about corruption. But then you find out, even with the so-called corruption in Africa, majority of the money winds up in Europe somehow. So to hear that Russians are money laundering in Europe, I'm not surprised by this because the European financial system launders billions upon trillions of dollars every year. So, you know, when they talk about so-called corruption in black countries and black areas, it's really a fake aid because at the end of the day, the money ends up in a European bank. So the Europeans are also corrupt. Also, I guess it showed how strong white supremacy is because if you think about country of Russia and Europe, they have been rivals, geopolitical rivals. You know, the continent of Europe, Russia, they've been geopolitical rivals for like 60, 70 years. I mean, we're talking nuclear war threats, and the Europeans are literally laundering money for the Russians. So that just shows you how strong the link of white supremacy is, that it can transcend the fact that these people have nuclear weapons pointed at each other. And, you know, I think that's something all black people should understand about how strong white supremacy is in terms of that aspect. Also, something I found interesting was the fact that white people are so angry about the fact that COVID-19 is not killing Africans. They are completely perplexed. If you looked at the initial reports and literally all the reports leading up to about August, they're still, you know, they were predicting millions of people dead in Africa. The whole continent, millions. You know, this would devastate all the black people, all the Africans. They don't know what to do. But as it turns out, it's not doing any of that, and they don't know why. So they're trying to say, oh, it's because we have this special immunity, and I don't doubt it. But again, even their models say, even with that so-called special immunity, you should still have hundreds of thousands dead. It's not happening. So I just think it shows that, you know, so-called Europeans, white people, necessarily do not have all the answers, and they know everything. And I think that's important as well, because if we were to follow their standards for the pandemic, you know, we would have had hundreds of thousands, millions dead. All those people dying in Italy, nothing like that has happened in Africa yet, and it will happen. And with that, I'm done.
Much obliged. I felt the same way, that it didn't seem like, you know, wow, this is amazing. What are they doing on the continent to keep this down? Like, we can learn from them. And wow, we got at least one. It did not sound like that at all. I'm like, man, we thought it was going to They skated by on the Rona. How did this happen? I will say I neglected to include India, if it hasn't already. I've seen reports just as of this week is about to overtake the United States for number one most COVID-19 cases. I did think that was extremely important. India, Nigeria, China, their particular so-called countries, non-white countries, that if I had a list, they would have an asterisk next to them. India is one. Nigeria is one. These are areas that white people have said, oh, wow, the next 100 years, extraordinary growth, development. They have enormous populations of non-white people. Like, oh, we got to be really concerned. Think like Lothrop Stoddard, rising tide of color against white world supremacy. I don't remember what he said about India, but that would be one location. Nigeria would be another. And to have India now as the number one spot in terms of number of cases of COVID-19, that so it would be India number one, U.S. two, and Brazil three, with a high population of black people in Brazil, still looks very much like white supremacy racism. Could be an error, but that is significant for the week. And case, since India is such a prominent part of case, India now being number one, that should be kept in mind as we read. Other folks who we missed totally, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Mo in Dallas. Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, listeners and callers. I don't have a word guide, but I did do a definition search for blood money. And I have like four definitions I'd like to read. Blood money, money acquired through killing and whatnot. Blood money, the fee paid to a higher killer. Blood money, money acquired from life insurance policies of ones you love, of your loved ones. Blood money, money paid to people. I thought this one was very interesting. Blood money, money paid to the family of a victim of an act of violence or for an untimely death. Death of a person who feels to bear some responsibility for the death. And blood money, if you have to commit an act of violence or if you have spent your whole life purposely waiting until someone dies to receive something of value from them. Those are the definitions I came across during a quick Google search. Speaking about the choline chemical, I did come in late. My mother recently actually had her choline checked. And to any victims who are getting their colon checked, she had to take an additional 2 days off of work. We don't use drugs in my family, and the drugs that they had to sedate her with had her just tired and just drained for like an extra 2 days. So if you have to undergo that procedure and you're allotted time off work, please take it. She drives for a living. So she definitely accepted the time off work. Also, I mentioned on workplace racism that I went to get my LTC in Texas, and I received I wrote a few things down, but I would just like to share this one thing. The instructor informed us that if we had been involved in discharging our firearms, so when we make the 911 call, dial 911, and he gave us a specific statement to give. I've been the victim of a violent crime. And then after that, you describe what you're wearing. And after that, you wait for the authorities to show. He made emphasis on not giving a full name, not mentioning that a gun was involved. And he also instructed us to step away from our cellular devices. Because if the authorities decide to call you back and you don't answer your phone, they have the ability to turn back on your smartphone and activate the microphone. Even if you Even if you don't answer and it, and the phone is on, they can turn it on. And if you, even if you turn it off, they can turn it, they can turn the phone back on and then turn the microphone on. So he advised anyone who was the victim of a violent crime to make sure that you're not near your cellular device to not be recorded. And don't say anything but get my lawyer. Those were the instructions I received in that course. I would also recommend that any victims review their state laws. Just, you know, if you get any time with this Breonna Taylor situation, I have never heard of a wonton law, but it does exist. And I think you would be interested to find out the laws that aren't used in your particular states. And I think it'll just be healthy recreation. Texas has some wild laws. Thank you. That's all I have for now. Mute my line.
Much obliged, Mo in Dallas. Thank you for the suggestion. Just trying to stay safe. I think I said when I made a report to enforcement officers, it was a white man being violent just about 2 months ago in August. The parking lot. This is the day before I left for the retreat, and I said I just called anonymously. I'm big time. If you have to make a phone report to enforcement officials, do so anonymously. You don't need to give out a lot of unnecessary information. Definitely good to know about. They can turn your phone back on and all the rest of that if you have to use a cell phone to dial in for enforcement officers. Did we have other folks that we have missed totally? Other folks we missed totally. You have a hand up. We have like 10 minutes or so left in the broadcast, so please do not wait till the last moment.
May I be heard?
Greetings, caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I wanted to first start out with the segment where they were talking about the protests in response to the decision in the Breonna Taylor case. I think they said it was like 150 something days of consecutive protests. And I noticed the term no justice, no peace was used. And then I know that that word peace, they consistently use that term in the news reports in regards to the nature of the protest. They say, oh, mostly peaceful. And it's interesting how that word is being utilized. Another term that I notice that white supremacists use in regards to the COVID-19, especially when it comes to the defiant white citizens, they use terms like fear and panic. I think from my understanding, they're using especially the word fear to like make a mockery of people, saying that people are cowardly and what's the big deal? And this isn't, you know, this isn't nothing to be in the house about or whatever, like literally in your house. And I say that to go on to an article that came out here locally where someone took a picture because Governor DeSantis, he made a, I guess, an order or an ordinance for the state to where they can go into phase three. So somebody took a picture and the local city commissioner posted the picture on Facebook, and it was like a line of people, like 30 people without a mask, in front of a bar or a local business. And just the confusion, you know, he was saying that these were more than likely University of Florida students. And he's like, I just don't get this. And I've tried to reach out to the University of Florida multiple times, and they just end up saying, well, we don't take responsibility for what the students do off campus. And I guess he used the word inappropriate. So, like, there's nobody being reprimanded, especially when you look on the photograph, it's mostly, of course, white students. So they got a comment from one of the students saying that it's just that he sees this all the time. It's a 23-year-old student. They didn't say if this guy was white. And he says, yeah, downtown, I see them walking downtown all the time without a mask, laughing and joking with each other. And they just don't think that this is an issue and this is something that can harm them. But they, what I notice is that they are not pointing out that these are white groups of young people. So I thought that was interesting how they're saying that, well, I can't say this person is responsible, and it might be that person, and it's not the university, it's not the city. So this person ended up posting, oh, you think we're playing, and watch what happens. I don't know if that's supposed to be some kind of a threat or what, but that's that was an article that was posted this week. And two more things. I think that was the paper associated with the Miami Herald. That term, I think, monster was used. It seemed like it was a lot of anti-blackness going on with that. And that term, communist or anti-communist, I found that interesting. And they said that this was allowed to go on for 8 months before any issue or anything was done about it. And one last thing, I looked through the word guide. I didn't see any word with the word blood in it. It just it mentions black and brown and things like that in the B section, but it didn't show anything on blood money. And that's all I have to share. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Thank you kindly. Got our word guide look. I was hoping I didn't have to, you know, dig mine out later on, but yes, not in there. I didn't think I remember that being in the word guide. As for the free white and 21 all year long, that's all the way back to March. I mean, first, hey, this thing called the Rona might be out here. We might need to hunker down. Got spring break going out to Daytona Beach. 7 months in, same thing. Can we distance? Can we take that? Going to the beach. Got beer pong. And nobody can do it. Same thing with the dirty money. Trillions. Can't do anything about that. White students, free white and 21. Can you make them behave? Follow the guidelines? Can't do anything about that either. And nobody's accountable. Any other folks have commentary they wanted to make sure they get in before we are all done? I can share one flick, maybe two, from one of our former suspected racist guests, a white male journalist. One of them, July 22, it's about Anders Breivik. I think it's on Netflix. It is on Netflix. I think it might be a Netflix film. But it's three parts. July 22, it's all about Anders Breivik and the Norway attack. It is obviously, it's all about white supremacy racism, if you know anything about that. But fascinating, and even the shooting, they do, like, dramatize that. It's not a documentary, but they do dramatize that, but that's quick. That's, like, the first 15 minutes, and then everything else is subsequent, like the trial and all of that. How did he get a PlayStation 5 and all the rest of it? Fascinating and all about white supremacy. Racism, if you did not pay attention to that case in 2011 because it happened on the other side of the world and all the rest of it, global system of white supremacy racism, July 22 is awesome. Spotlight is pretty good too, not directly about white supremacy racism. It's about the Catholic Church sex abuse scandal. But I watched it and I said, man, that is, what does that idiot say? White people do not care about children. They got so many of these documentaries on white people abusing children. They got the Anthony Weiner one, and they got the Jeffrey Epstein one, and this one, and I mean, it just goes on and on and on. White people do not care about that. That's actually July 22 as well, because Anders Breivik went and killed white children, killed them by the dozen, too. That's dramatized in the film. But they do not care about children, and white people claiming ignorance that came up with the sex abuse scandal. The Boston Globe, that's what Spotlight is about, the Boston Globe kind of breaking, so-called, this report about all this child rape happening in the church and them covering it up and moving these priests around. Even the Boston Globe, the whites at the Boston Globe, even they, when they were going around being high and mighty and trying to gather information, you're going to tell us we're doing a story on this, and they've been raping hundreds of children, and blah, 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 and they knew about it. And I think several folks finally came back and said, hey, wait a minute. We tried to tell you years ago. We sent information to the Boston Globe, and you didn't care. And they kept saying it, they kept saying it. Finally, they said, wait a minute. They did send us this information. We did know they sent us a list of like 24 children had been raped, and yeah, we published the story and didn't follow up on it. No big deal. Got sidetracked because this, I think, was going back to things happening in the 90s and all that. The film is set in 2001. But like, yeah, white people are not ignorant. That was one of the more what they call painful points. How ignorant can we say we were about all this, really? Spotlight, July 22, if you need two Netflix films to watch. Reading more important than watching television. Yes, Irie.
Last comment. It's interesting that along with that report about the illegally traded money, Russia being implemented and stuff, I just read that Russia has officially claimed the planet Venus for themselves. They sent two probes out initially 1967 and then 1970. So I guess if you're doing a lot of illegal trading with your money and, you know, stuff like that, you could possibly have enough money to sequester and protect your planet, you know, and that's all.
Context of white supremacy. I did see that. How do you purchase a like they were talking about how do you purchase, you know, a beach and so how do you purchase a whole planet? Is the sun for sale? Anywho, that white people arguing with Russia, Minister Malcolm spoke about that some years back, I think, rather eloquently. White people, they do not brawl and argue that much. I mean, they do mistreat white people, mistreat other white people. We see that here. Absolutely. They don't brawl and fight that much. Whatever little arguments they have between each other on a small scale, Hatfields and McCoys, they rape their own children, or large scale, U.S. and Russia, Europe and whatever it is, Europe and Russia. There's not even a definitive dividing line. Where's the end of Europe and the beginning of Russia? Anybody get that one? Anyway, they don't beat that much. White people, they are in it, it being the system of white supremacy all the way. Disputes and all of that, none of that is going to disrupt from their unification. You talk about united independent towards dominating non-white people in the known universe, apparently, even out Venus, all the rest of them. Any other comments before we wrap? Thomas in New York.
Yes. Well, Russia is actually the most populous country in Europe because if you look at it on the map, they have the part where Moscow and St. Petersburg, or I think it's called Stalingrad. But either way, those two sections are in Europe, and then there's this imaginary line, which the rest of them are in Asia. But I believe Russia has like nine time zones. It's huge. Last thing, this was appalling to me. I get a text message, invitation to a funeral, open casket funeral, and they're doing it on Zoom. And I felt like that is so impersonal. And I didn't even respond. Like, I just feel like that's terrible. I mute my line, thank you.
I think we talked about that imaginary line in more detail with Ian Hani Lopez, White by Law. He was talking about the whole way that whites have and continue to maintain the fabrication of so-called race, very essential for maintaining white supremacy racism, but they just make up these categories as they go and base it on whatever they want to base it on. But I think we talked about that imaginary line. But the Zoom funerals, I feel like I've heard that before. I think I've heard, you know, some other folks, because they've had for so long the restrictions on gatherings and funerals, and, you know, people have thought talked about the difficulty, you know, because that's part of the grieving process, to be able to mourn together and kind of have that last visit with the remains and everything, and not being able to grieve properly since you can't have those final ceremonies, I guess, you know, Zoom. I think some people had already had reported here on the broadcast saying that they were doing the services like on YouTube and, you know, these other type of video conference services. Oof, man, I can totally feel you on it, not feeling personal, and I guess people are trying to compensate as best they can to try to have some sort of contact with others if someone transitions, so that they can kind of say their farewells and have some sort of, you know, connection and ceremony about it. But, yeah, I guess for some people that might be better than others, better than nothing. But, yeah, I can feel you. That's I think the folks were saying the same thing about YouTube because, you know, anybody conceivable, anybody would have access to that. Didn't hear. Folks, we're satisfied? Everyone satisfied?
Oh, very last thing, Asian, defined in the 1828 dictionary, is considered the other side of the mountains. They call it the Ashes. So the word Asian comes from ashes, and those mountains today, like Mount St. Helens, and I guess you would call them the Caucasus. So that's the imaginary line.
Again, we talked about all that in detail. Ian Hani Lopez, White by Law, 2009. Much obliged for folks chiming in. Hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. We will be back Monday and Wednesday, all white people on the program, Whites Only. If you have other questions, suggestions, feel free to just drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, if you need other information. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We need our brain computer working well to solve these problems. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled every time we are in a vehicle. I would still contend, let's hunker down. Lots of reasons, all of the zaniness with the protests and what have you, that's been way beyond Kentucky in terms of people protesting and all the rest of that. Still lots of armed whites roaming out and about. Be a good time to still stay home unless you have to be out. And if you are going to go out, you are super alert to what's happening around you. If it looks like somebody's being loud and violent, out of there. Get back to the residence. We can try this at a time when it is a little bit safer. But again, sober, buckled. If you are behind the wheel, you are not on the cell phone. That way we can be paying attention what's going on around us, to minimizing contact with enforcement officers, badge or no, just trying to do the small things that we can to keep ourselves as safe as possible under conditions of total universal terrorism, even on Venus. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.